Hello, I'm James Vanneval, back with Gareth Stack on the fifth episode of Reading Plays. This is a show where we take some plays, usually some of our favourites and sometimes suggested by listeners. We read them and we analyse, break them down and talk about them a lot. Hello, Gareth.
Hello, James.
I also want to give a quick thanks to
the Marvellous Theatre subreddit,
Miss Glitastain, Tash Crime, Ham Free, who gave us a huge list, Matt the Scot, Red Bearded Owl, Jazzy Clan, Frida Celeste or Frida Celeste, and Mystery Mud.
Those were all the people kind enough to lend suggestions as to what we should cover over the coming months and years. Because it really would. If we went through that whole list, it would be several years.
It would be. It'd be too much of a commitment. I'm actually really thankful we didn't commit anything.
Haven't even committed to next week.
Yeah, exactly.
Some people sent a lot of plays and a lot of plays I'd never heard of, and you know, send me down those treasure trails where you're looking on Wikipedia. Oh, he also wrote that. That was banned. Ooh.
Mm.
And then I got the banned plays thing. And,
that's even better. Yeah, I've been grabbing the blacklisted ones as well. I mean, that's a whole other wiki fall / wiki walk. But this week's play is a little bit more well known. From 1666, it's Molière's Misanthrope.
That's right, James.
Yes.
The Misanthrope or The Cantankerous Lover by Molière, a classic comedy first performed at the Théâtre du Palais Royal in 1666. Despite its age, the play deals with modern concerns, like the nature of friendship and the choice to embrace cynicism over solipsism. Although absent the careful plotting, dynamic staging, or linguistic experimentalism of modern theatre, Molière's wit remains alive and entertaining. The influence of his barbed dialogue and high society brinkmanship. I always thought it was brinksmanship.
Yeah, me too. I would add in brinkmanship. It's brinkmanship, yeah.
Can be seen in writers from Oscar Wilde to Whit Stillman. Mm. In life, Molière, born Jean-Baptiste Poquelin.
I'm sure whoever really respects him loves this part where you keep trying.
Poquelin was a controversial figure. Arguably one of the first literary celebrities, he was accused of numerous villainies, including having illegitimately fathered his much younger wife. I'm hoping that's going to be on my tombstone, aren't you? He once wrote, "Doubts are more cruel than the worst of truths," and it is this ambiguity that lies at the heart of The Misanthrope. Molière writes, "One cannot look into the heart. Thus we vacillate between paranoia and pronoia, never certain in this life of the nobility of our actions or whether moral pragmatism is ultimately more valid than holding a steady course. Is it true, as the cynically flirtatious Célimène says, it is easy to blame or praise everything and everyone may be right according to their age and taste? Or is there a moral centre to life we may avoid or obey according to our character?" Today we read the Henry van Loon public domain translation of the play from the University of Adelaide.
Yes, which is, it's still the classic taking of it though, but just a nice translation into English, which keeps some of the better parts of the Manners novel language, which it really is full of that as well, Manners novel stuff, which we'll get into a little bit later.
It does drop the rhyming though. I don't know if it was in the original, but I know the original translations had a rhyme scheme, which is de-emphasized. There's still some rhyming, but it's not.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, in fact, there is even a rhyme that has to be in the play because of a sonnet that's read out. But other than that, you're right. It takes away some of it's more prose. Let's put it that way. But then again, it has to be. And I really enjoyed it, actually. It's one of our... This is our fifth play. It's definitely our oldest.
This was written actually when I was a young man. So I remember seeing the first production.
When you used to walk into school and people were stealing your lunch.
In my tights and large codpiece. They would steal my... what do people eat in 1666?
I don't know. I was even trying to think of someone's name. Like, I was even trying to think of someone from that time. It's like, he used to beat you up and take
your lunch. Clobberwalk would beat me up and steal my lunch farthing for the year.
So if anyone can't tell, this is way beyond our historical knowledge. This is way, way back.
Back in the depths of history.
Absolutely. This is kind of obviously post-Renaissance, but still carrying some of that flavour in the 1600s kind of language. But what it will become for people who are interested, if you've ever read much 19th century industrial fiction, but particularly the thing called the Manners novel, and some of it's in the 1800s as well, and great examples of it in its more satirical form will be Wilkie Collins in the late 1800s with Lady in White. But you might also think of people like, the Bronte sisters to an extent later on. But then if you go further back, Jane Austen was writing what is essentially Manners novels, which is people, it's usually around the concept of fantastically eloquent or at least high society language, with landed gentry types meeting up with noble types and often the two meeting up or in some cases clashing off one another. But underhanded motivations and needs and despotic drives in people that coexist with languages which defer all of those things. They're all about function and systemization and recognizing class. And this is a really, really, I thought it was a great kind of titular example of what's going to come in the 1700s and 1800s. And Liaisons Dangereux is obviously the most famous one that I've read, which is a Manus novel of the 1800s. And that's a fascinating thing to look at if you then jump forward and then take the 19th century variations of it, which is all about satirizing that. Because, of course, the Industrial Revolution would bring a breakdown of a lot of those types of classes differences. The poor are becoming wealthy and things like that.
I think you're right. You can draw a direct line from The Misanthrope to Les Liaisons Dangereuses to Dickens and Austen and Woody Allen, and this kind of comedy of manners, but there are serious concerns about status and morality underlying them. And it's what makes these kinds of things so enjoyable, because they're so light and frivolous and ridiculous. But at the same time, I mean, this play asks some philosophical questions about what it means to be a good person and what we should tolerate that I haven't seen in very many modern plays or movies, maybe mumblecore movies being the most notable example, the early 2000s American microgenre.
Yeah, fun microgenre as well. The thing about taking these concepts, though, and putting them out in this kind of language is it doesn't really work today unless done with a kind of knowing, ironic twinge to it, where it's put in with a lot of postmodern conceits and production. Today you wouldn't have this kind of play, and we know this because there's a modern version, which I think you're going to mention later on in the play or in this show. You couldn't take something like this, because the philosophical points you just mentioned are very front loaded, they're top heavy, they're right there. You can kind of tell they're barely being hidden behind the language, because the Misanthrope, being the arch centralized character here of oh my God, I was about to actually forget his name, which was really, really stupid, but it's because of Alceste, I think it is.
It is,
yeah.
Alceste.
Alceste, yeah. You hear the flicking of a page, but I remembered it. Yeah.
They are quite, we're going to butcher the pronunciations. If anyone's listening and you're from Montreal or France, or you have even eaten in a bistro, you'll probably be terribly insulted.
Eaten in a bistro, is that it?
That's enough of a qualification.
That's your continental connection. Yeah, if you've gone into Italianissimo or whatever, you know, Prete Manger, you'd probably know all about this.
When I start a political party, our slogan will be, if you've eaten in a bistro, we're going to kick you into the sea.
Yeah, bomb the cafes. That's very true. That's where your existentialists meet. You can't trust them. But this, I have to tie this back into what I was just saying, and yet I've forgotten. Oh, yes. Yeah, the main character, he front loads a lot of his philosophies. Right from the start, you can kind of tell what he's the contrarian. His contrarianism is meant to reflect a crucial problem in communication in society. But I kind of like the way postmodernism has made those things a little bit more subtle. Mm-hmm. I also like that there's a lot more room in today's plays for multiple themes to kind of hide amongst language, as opposed to language back then being very strictly a code of showing class and possibilities of kinship. And the only room left is for a man to come along and say, that's stupid, which is essentially what, I mean, obviously he does it in a much more beautiful prose, right, that I can't copy. But that's his function overall. In fact, by the end of the play, which I can't ruin now, but he doesn't really do much. Do you ever notice that? There's not much happening for him.
Let's not ruin the big twist
in this
400-year-old or 350-year-old play. The absence of plot is probably the most striking thing. Mm-hmm. And I think in a very literal way, this sits midway between Greek drama, which is wholly allegorical, and contemporary drama, which tries to do it all. Often you have your surface naturalistic dialogue or surrealistic dialogue, and then your metaphor, and then your grand metaphor, and your broken metaphor, and your symbols. And I mean, it's, right now it's hard, but in Molière's day, you just had to be pretty witty.
Yeah,
have a few ideas.
And then people took that as your conversational tone, because the signatory authors were much bigger back then too. The author was as much talking to his audience at all times. So when you read it, it was as much like you're reading his conversation. He was filling in the Suzette where there was none. And I'm sorry for bringing in the narratology terms of Fabula and Suzette, which everyone can yawn at because they've heard it a fucking thousand times.
I haven't heard Suzette, so explain it to me.
Okay, well, Suzette is, Fabula is the more allegorical telling.
I think I fancied her in school, actually.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
She had little ringlets.
Oh, that's
gorgeous.
I can't even imagine this. I don't actually know who would be called Suzette. I like the idea, though,
she's
of the
a
name.
Skip.
Oh, okay.
No, I'm making this up. I didn't.
I know, but I'm trying to actually picture who it would be. So Suzette is the method of a plot being told. So in other words, how it's told, the mimesis, or how it's shown to you. Who's talking, the conversation and the direction it's going, the conflicts that are appearing through whatever the actions are. The fabula is the measured allegorical look at a story of what's, you know, happening point to point.
Okay.
So Fabula is, this is what happened from point to point, Gareth. And the Suzette is how you're perceiving it, how it's translating in the moment. The mise-en-scene itself is the Suzette, how it's being shown through.
Thank you very much for that. Yeah. I've often wondered how to better explain the difference between plot and what's happening in in story. I didn't. I
it's Todorovsky kind of stuff. It's the Russian formalist and structuralist era of the 1800s as well as the 1900s going through.
And now if I'm ever trying to impress a girl called Suzette, I can pull out this and contrast her to her sister that I'll contrive to call Fabula.
Yeah, yeah.
And it'll be a whole bit.
It's going to be a real struggle for you to connect those two things. But if you can manage it, you'll really impress.
You haven't seen me in action.
Okay.
And that's what this play is all about. It's about trying to pull.
Yeah, it is. In a world. In fact, this whole show.
in a world where...
If I could get back to one of the names. No.
In a world where it was a great deal more difficult. And you mentioned he's writing for his audience, and his audience are other nobility in 17th century France. But it's surprisingly, to use an awful term, relatable.
Mm-hmm. That's not awful.
The characters and insecurities and neuroses are very modern, albeit in this rarefied land where they beat their servants.
Yeah.
And everyone has a carriage to storm off in.
Exactly.
And they've been insulted.
And half the time they're just complaining about how they could have been somewhere else, which I really enjoyed too.
I found as I was reading it that I could understand it a lot better if I imagined that all the characters were 10 years old. And instead of running to the king, they were running to the teacher. You know, because they really are these bizarrely immature vessels.
Yeah. Well, it says a lot about civilization as well. In different eras in civilization, you could say that the emotional turpitude that people were going through, the ability to actually convey and respond to emotions was that of a 10-year-old. You could say generationally they never grew up there, but while they had high society language, that was all built on something that they were ignorant of. And
this is at a period in history. I mean, we're being kind of falsely condescending to the past, ironically.
So easy though, isn't it?
But this is a period of history where to be a town in France required you to have a flogging post, a pillory. This is a period in history where they, if you refused to answer questions, they couldn't make you. You were legally allowed not to answer them. They would put a stone under your spine and keep piling more stones onto you until your body exploded. So this is a world really quite different from Rome. And yet here are these within this bubble. It's almost like people who work for Google live in a socialist utopia. Mm-hmm. All your food is free and you get massages and they'll sort out a lift to work.
And there is a kind of king. It's called a computer.
There's a kind of king. It's called Larry Page. but in this case, there's a literal king. And if you were part of his, all of these people in the play are mates with the king, or they're courtiers to the king, or their dad was a courtier to the king. And they're in a rarefied realm. This is not very long before Marie Antoinette would be beheaded and nobility lose its magical charm, but they are still in that Dauphin Prince kind of styly, where things are pretty chill.
Yeah, they're pretty much all right. In fact, the only person, Alceste, is the main character, and by the way, is the kind of eponymous misanthrope in the story. He's the only point where you could probably find access as a modern day audience, and not even just being cynical, but just being challenging of some what are pretty blindingly obvious hypocrisies of the time he's in.
Yeah, and yet his servant emerges at one point in the play and he immediately calls him a wretch and threatens to knock his block off.
And is really annoyed that he won't get to information faster for him.
So, and he talks about common humanity, but I'm pretty sure it's common humanity with other inordinately wealthy white people from noble blood in 17th century France.
With this kind of unhinged in its firing, but completely never stated idea that much like the much more horrible racist ideals that came from Kant, which is there's certain ebbs of society who just don't, you know, can't evolve to this language. They're there because they're supposed to be there.
And at this point in history, they didn't even need to, that's not even on the table. It's not like they have any kind of discussion.
We're very far away from the Charles X revolution of France. That's not going to happen for a long time.
You can imagine the rabble sort of in that movie Perfume eating and birthing in the gutter.
And how terrible it is.
It's a great movie.
Yeah, it's okay. Disappointed at the time.
So will we do our patented read the entire play in order?
I think we should just establish first the characters. Just
of course.
Who's
in
play here?
So our main character, the misanthrope of the title, is Alceste, who's in love with Célimène.
Célimène, yes.
Célimène.
Célimène, if you want.
How would you describe Célimène?
I don't know, because I'd have to spoil so much immediately, because I'm just going to go straight for the... I'm going to cut the throat, you know, go straight for the heart.
Oh, well, okay. Well, we can at least say that she is a coquette and a contrarian.
I feel you had those adjectives very ready, Gareth. That's right.
Written on the page in front of me.
Well delivered.
And so he has a mate called Philinte, which is kind of close to Philistine. I don't speak French. I don't know if there's a joke there. But he's a more pragmatic sort and very stable compared to Alceste, who's the angry young man of...
Yeah, Philinte is kind of the foil of the story. He acts in the same way as you, and not to make a bad comparison, but it is quite true. In the Shakespearean sense, he's the foil to the more tragic character in the story. He's there to kind of go, oh, you, that's true, that's ridiculous. I'm much more simple in my thinking. That he's that kind of...
I am your Philinte.
Yes.
You are my Alceste.
Oh, that's wonderful. I take that take great credit in that.
So then there's Elaine T.
I'm sure Jesus. It's
Elaine, a noble lady, cousin of Salamine, who doesn't have much personality, but does have affection.
But apparently she's super hot and very, very much the person you want to get with in terms of lordship. You know, she's got connections.
She can sort stuff out with the king. And yes. she is in love with our protagonist, who has eyes only for her cousin.
Mm-hmm.
Which brings us to...
Probably because she's younger. Okay, so you've done a lot. Oh, I'm not going to try. Okay,
who's described later as the little Marquis in a cutting jibe. He's a smug noble, full of himself and dresses very well and so on. And then Cleandre.
A dandy noble Marquis suitor for Selimene. One of the many suitors for
Everyone Selimene. Else in this play is some form of suitor for the hot Selimene.
Who has just apparently turned 20. Oh. At least it suggested she's turned 20.
Oh, really?
That she's 20. And the crisis comes up because later on in the play, when reflecting with... why do I keep forgetting names so far?
Maybe just stay on the name page of the Kindle.
Yeah, I'm not on a Kindle. This is my mind. Alceste is obviously a little bit annoyed that Selimene is apparently not very interested in him, or she's interested in him in very selective ways, but won't make anything public about it, so as to keep constant maintenance of all these other men. And Elaine is... she says, oh yeah, she's 20, she's keeping her youth. I mean, I wouldn't be one to judge her. I'm just saying I have respect for you, Alceste, you know, please choose me. And Alceste goes, it does state pretty much like, I know you're 20 and you have things to keep. Or at least someone mentions it, and Selimene then makes it very clear. So just to make this clear for people at the time, particularly in 1666, you want, as a young girl, if you're very attractive, you're coming from a certain amount of lordship, you're in high society, you're being allowed to, I was about to say some famous part in France, when I've just blanked on Paris. Doesn't matter. Either way, at that point in your life, either you're going to commit to marry the most effective and best suitor, the best male, or you're going to keep them on play. But there is a lot to be lost in choosing a wrong suitor. So this is a very, like, she's a pivotal point in life. Okay, this is real debutante time.
This is the great difference between, I'm reading the play today, it's impossible, we can imagine, but we can't really get into the mindset of a situation where you really do need to choose a partner for life, or at least until their death, however that's arranged. And it's a very important thing, and you're very young. And you have all of the raging hormones that we have to this day, and more, because you're in such a, in some ways, primitive society. But you're making this big decision. And if you even impugn, as we learn later in the play, that if you impugn that you're not of a virtuous nature, your reputation could be ruined in society, and you might as well toss yourself on the gutter with the rabble.
Mm-hmm.
Or at least move to a smaller castle.
Yeah, a smaller the city. Castle. Just go to a different pool, basically, a smaller one. You know how it is. Let's talk in horrible, forcefully Darwinist shelling terms. Now, the next character is Arisno, or Arisno, depending on how you want to pronounce that. It's described as a prudish lady, in love with Alceste as well, of course, and friend of Selima. Now, I think we should also mention that Arisno is a much older lady.
Much older. She could be 22. It's never...
But it's old enough to matter back then.
I mean, everyone died at 25.
And she's described as being a little bit older as well, and someone who's maybe lost her handsomeness, as described by Selimene. And she's very jealous of Selimene, because Selimene has Alceste's heart, and Arisno wants it. But interesting enough, she's the foil to Selimene. She's also the future echo of what she's going to become. She's this woman who's gone past her age, where she once had great handsomeness and beauty, and only maintains the idea of it in her prudishness and how she lies about her home.
So she is the carry.
Mm-hmm.
Selimene is I'm trying to think if she's the... I guess she's like a young... She's like a young Samantha.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah. Okay.
I'm kidding. I'm not gonna do that.
I'll work with you. I'm a very good enabler. I'm forgiving. So Arant is the thick. You saying here thick skinned?
It's supposed
poet.
To say thin skinned poet.
A thin skinned poet.
You don't have to read directly from my notes, which I give you only as courtesy, rather than a substitute for your own thoughts.
But this is because I'm incapable of much thought. Friendly with the king, also a suitor of Selimene. So yeah, this is a bit more important, because this is the real challenge, as established early on, for Alceste. Alceste sees this person as kind of the complete underling, and it's very much apparent in Arant's first scene, which I think is around, it's Act 1, Scene 3 or 4, in how he approaches Alceste, that he loves his opinion, he wants his popularity and clout to be reflected in his judgment of a poem that Arant has written. So Arant is like, please like my poem, please review it with all of your critical thinking that you show and your honesty, like everything about you is...
People really respect
They really respect Alceste. His wit, as they call it.
It's hard to understand why, because he is a dick.
That's brilliant.
Let's get it out here.
That's brilliant because later on he is caught saying, as he makes a horrible remark about going off to be in court, it says in the background everyone is laughing and he says, I don't think I said anything funny. What I think this play is really about is how this man is actually very depressed, has got a serious mental problem and in his dismay and in his honesty, they take it as wit. In fact, they consistently give it a manner term, wit.
What an anachronistic interpretation.
What an amazing
he
one.
He has a borderline personality disorder, type 2.
I don't know if it's BPD. I'm not saying it's BPD, but like it's a recognised... Depression goes way back. Depression's obvious.
I would strongly disagree. Depression is a culture bent syndrome. In China, for example, neurasthenia was classically diagnosed and still today, completely a different set of symptoms.
Uh-huh.
And I think you're pathologizing a philosophy. It was very clear in the play that this is a philosophy of life.
Yeah, of course, it's a philosophy. It's not total pathologizing, of course, because I'm just taking the modern term for it, but it's sadness nonetheless.
If anything, he's dysthymic in psychoanalytic terms.
And what would be...
He's a misery guts.
If it was to take Antonio from The Merchant of Venice when he opens with, in sooth, I know not why I'm so sad, and he describes in a very lengthy opening what is very similar to being depressed, what would that be?
That's major depression.
Okay.
I'll deign to anachronistically diagnose
okay,
Antonio.
Right. You need to mention for people that Alceste is, whether you think he's sad or not, it appears that he doesn't necessarily find what he's saying very funny, but he's credited with wit at all times.
You know, but in all seriousness, I was being flippant, but if we were to impose a contemporary diagnosis, I wouldn't say he's depressed. Well, he's unhappy, but I think he would be something like aspergic. He's not aware of the effect he has on people. He doesn't understand social cues. He's irate that people aren't honest and sincere. I mean, these are all very kind of 13-year-old boy / aspergic.
Yeah.
No, I'm not casting any aspersions on anyone.
No.
The only other characters remaining are servants and don't matter. They really don't.
They don't, no.
They're literally there to be yelled at.
Mm-hmm.
So we've got Selamine, just to go over it. Beautiful love, everyone's in love with her. Alceste, the main character, his friend Filinte, whatever,
Filinte,
and a couple of other ladies and several other dudes. Dudes,
yeah.
I feel like Keanu bros. Reeves teaching history class, who all want to sleep with Selamine.
Yes, and the crucial problem, like all great plays, unravels from a simple one, which is the Nishi Alceste wanting a kind of a confession from Selamine, which then unravels as he meets the other characters under the suitors, who each in their own private but not very well kept private ways want Selamine's attention, in fact devotion to them. So that kind of is where the real plot is, if there even is any, which is this great meeting with Selamine that they all kind of go to at what I assume to be her party or her house. That they all get, of course, chauffeured to in beautiful carriages with their butlers. And each one of them goes through kind of very loosely. I mean, because Alceste is given a lot more build-up than the rest of them, given a lot more establishment. They go through loosely what it is that they're obsessed about Selamine or what it is that they feel about them. And then you become very, very suspicious immediately because they seem to have a lot more invested in her based on what she's saying to them.
She's quite clearly very hot.
Yeah, she must be super hot.
In whatever terms we can apply that to the 17th century, she's got it all. Hotness, that's all she's got.
Yeah.
But she's got it all.
Piece ass, probably, yeah.
She's very cute.
Mm-hmm.
And people constantly say, oh, you know, I would that I could, I deplore the feelings your beauteous visage has drawn out of me. You are a wrench, you know. Everyone mm-hmm. hates her, but they really fancy her.
Yeah,
so clearly, there's a lesson there.
No, I'm not getting it. Go on.
Just, you know, Molière is commenting on the vacuity of male passion and how simple we are. What simple creatures, that there are various girls who all have different kinds of noble traits throughout the play, all of whom are ignored in favour of Selamine, who is...
It goes deeper than that, please. There's multiple levels, even to the credibility he gives to other people. This is what I was saying earlier.
Well, let's get to that.
Okay.
After we go through the play.
Oh, so we're going to go through. Okay, I'm happy with that.
So, Act 1, Scene 1. We've got an argument between Alceste and his friend. And basically, this is the first question of the play. We've got these two young nobles. Basically, they're Holden Caulfield in the form of Alceste and Algernon Moncrief from The Importance of Being Earnest in Filinte. And they're arguing over whether you should be friendly with everyone, sweet-natured, ignore hypocrisies, minor, in favour of politis, is that what it is, politisme? The the courtly politeness that was key to French society and is still key to society today in the middle class West. Or you should be sincere. You should be, you know, Zarathustra. You should strive for honesty and decry the wretches who, and their vile politeness.
Yeah, yeah. I'm trying to think of a more classical character that would have inspired constant honesty. But yes, there is that. There is this kind of Virgil nobleman, will you be a of the classic Greek texts and stay honest to exactly all of your aims, which means in today's world insulting everybody and possibly losing any connection that you could use to build a career or whatever it is the hell that Alceste does. Because
it's it's hard to understand for us because, you know, when you have all of the money in France and you live in a castle and you have servants, I mean...
I don't know what his career path is because it's made reference to that there was a book written badly in his name or something. There's that.
There seems to have been a slander.
A slanderous book. And then at the start, his anger, by the way, you should just explain, Alceste and Philinte are arguing over the concept that Garrett just mentioned, but they're also seemingly arguing, we're coming midway into the argument. Something must have started it. And we're to assume that there's a case coming up. The case is what's making Alceste annoyed and want to remove himself from humanity. And Philinte is just saying to him, all you have to do is make a few connections and you'll be fine.
There's also another reason for their argument. I mean, the case is actually never explained. There are three cases referenced in the play. And it seems as though we're at a point in history where jewels have been abandoned in France in favour of lawsuits. So as not to stain the outfits, presumably.
Yeah.
And this is an argument about love. This is Alceste saying that Philinte, are not being faithful to our friendship. And this brings in kind of the other main themes of the play, which is male romance and friendship as this very intense, jealous kind of thing. There's this exchange between them where Alceste says, I see you almost stifle a man with caresses. next minute you're not friends with me, you know. And Philinte responds by sort of saying, well, you know, you all it takes for someone to disappoint you is the merest hint of not being perfect in your eyes, and you'll hate them forever. I, on the other hand, I'm kind with all.
Well, it's also about raillery, which is like there's an understandable level of insultingness that has to happen in our relationship, because they mention raillery, by the way, a concept which is to be a little bit discourteous but in a fun, formal way, to rib at someone.
Banter.
To banter, let's say. But it is to rib at them. And the joke here is that raillery is always at play. In fact, they're probably railing throughout the entire play, but at certain sections they're saying, that's too much raillery. So they're detecting the point where you're going overboard. And there's a fantastic quote, one of my favourites from the start, from Philinte, which is, rail a little less or rail a little less at your opponent and attend a little more to your suit. And what he's trying to say there, amongst everything else with the clothing, by the way, clothing imagery comes up a lot as a theme, he's trying to say, care more about your reputation, which is always at stake in this world, and a little less about what your actual feelings are. Because that's the big problem with Alceste. Throughout the play, he kind of 2 points brings up other people's clothing and mentions that is a reason why Célimène is probably interested in them or why women are attracted to them. So we can get an idea that maybe he's probably clothed quite well, but he doesn't care too much about it. That reputation is for something he can't quite either detect or doesn't really feel, so doesn't give a shit about it. While Philinte is someone who probably props up and maintains Alceste's reputation and cares more about it than he does.
And maybe I could be guessing. I'd have to know more about France and read the original play, but I get the impression that Alceste is from a better family than Philinte. He doesn't have to try it. He's so far removed from having to struggle for his status that he's solely concerned with what he wants, whereas Philinte is more pragmatic, and maybe he has to be. Maybe he is only 10 generations of nobility instead of 30 or something. But I could be guessing.
I mean, that's the thing we have to guess with a lot of this. We should mention that there's no real set direction. There's a few things that they're that are informed in the script to do, such as who looks at who and who enters. But other than that, there's very little description of the scenery, no description of the scenery and environments. It's only establishing what they say in the dialogue.
Presumably because every play had men in wigs and tights.
Yeah.
And you just had to switch them around.
Yeah, no one was really dressed up. There's only a few sections where someone's referenced on off stage as being dressed a certain way and having wigs as well. So yeah, Alceste and Philinte are having this discussion at the start. And that's the kind of point they get to, which is... Philinte is kind of saying, well, would you stop with the jibery? And Alceste is saying some really kind of harsh things. He's saying to him, like, you know, you're a completely dishonest person. You don't have any consistency in what you say. So how can it have any meaning?
Yeah, he says he describes people who aren't constant and who aren't sincerely in their passion for one person as these affable dispensers of meaningless embraces, these obliging utterers of empty words.
Yeah.
And he says preference must be based on esteem, and to esteem everyone is to esteem no one. So we really have a it's presented in comedic terms, but we have a real fundamental conflict about how you see the world. And it's one that I face myself, and perhaps everyone does, or only neurotics, I don't know.
Mm-hmm.
But whether you, how, to what extent you should be a morally judgmental person. For example, let's just pick a contemporary example. If you're in a bar with your friend, and you're also friends with his girlfriend, and he kisses another girl, should you tell the girlfriend?
No, don't tell anyone. I told you not to fucking say it.
I'm going to tell your girlfriend. I'm sorry, man. So
she never listens.
That's it. Not yet, but... But that, I mean, that's it. That might seem like a trivial example, and it's got nothing to do with the play. But that's the kind of moral conflict he's talking about. Like, how much should we impose our own moral judgments on those around us? And if we don't, are we moral at all?
Yeah.
So the questions here are not great questions of morality. Should I save a child from a fire?
No, not at all.
You know, they're minor questions, but they're probably more important because they're the kind of ones that we face all the time in life.
It's about the availability of being honest in exactly everything that you say at all times, no matter who's in the room or what the presence is or how familiar they are with you. It's about letting your inner daemon speak outwards at all times. And if not, then how can your words have meaning by any metric of their delivery? So they either mean something or they don't. Now, it seems like today, like a dubious, what I'm saying is a dubious extrapolation of an obvious argument that goes on quite a lot, actually. There's a few, I know television dramas that deal a lot more with it today than ever did in the past. But the crisis here appears because Alceste is really, like, in one way he's right. He's saying to Valente, look, I can't abide by this constant bigging up of people, or as he puts it, flattery. This flattery that goes nowhere, consistent flattery, which is more about transactions of the words, as in, like, literally money, words as currency, to keep us all in the same floating boat, to maintain something I don't really care about. I can't do that because either I need to feel the word, and I'm having a crisis of feeling. And that's probably where a lot of this comes from, especially since this is just an echo of a bigger discussion he has to have with Célimène, but he's not ready to have yet. This discussion at the start, in fact, becomes the same discussion he has towards the end of the play with Célimène. So this is, you know, it is crucial in the art, and the philosophy is, I mean, I'm trying to say the philosophy he's putting forth is important. But Alceste is also, like everyone else in the play, completely hypocritical, which really makes me think that is this really more about hypocrisy than anything else? I mean, that's the standout theme for me. We can take some of what he's saying and feel it. But I also think that at this stage, I don't know, as the play goes on, it just feels less and less important. Do you see what I'm saying? Like the concept of being honest to oneself.
So Alceste is forced in a variety of scenarios, quite comically, to not live up to his own standards of perfect honesty. And it is apparently the way it's staged in general is to be staged so as he's a figure of mockery. And apparently Jean-Jacques Rousseau was the author of The Social Contract, and he was furious because he thought this is a great play, Molière's greatest play, and Alceste was a great moral figure and he was held up as a figure of comedy. But Rousseau famously was so incapable of dealing with people that he married a fool or an imbecile, as they referred to at the time, a mentor mentally handicapped woman, so that he wouldn't have to deal with someone who would talk back to him.
Yeah.
So, not to criticize anyone listening who's married to an imbecile.
Yeah. Because it's already been done every day. Criticism is
everyone around you is probably getting the digs in.
Again, we're Alceste here. We'll be honest about it. We'll confess it.
Well, this is the conflict of the play. Where do you fall? Maybe everyone has a little bit of Alceste and a little bit of Valentine, or maybe we've all been Alceste in our teenage years and become Valentines, or maybe we were always Valentine and then we tried marijuana at 40 and became a little bit of an Alceste.
Yeah. Which one's the graduation point? Which one's graduation either into the concept we call now adulthood or what they would have called then going into higher society, which is the aim. Now, he's already in some ways in higher society, but he's missing connections.
Yeah, he's not quite besties with the king.
He's not quite there. Yeah, exactly. And he needs to be besties with the king to be really high society.
It's almost incomprehensible because we think now of royal families, we think of, you know, people standing on plinths above 5,000, waving a hand and then going back in to enjoy.
Half what you're paid to be there, waving British flags.
But at this point in history, you have a sufficiently large nobility that you can be a marquis, but you don't actually know the king.
Yes,
you're there's probably a few thousand of these creatures roaming around France in their fancy garments.
But it's the level of degrees you're connected to the king that's important too. So not even, the, I think later on it may be said, I don't know if it's by Yolande, but there's a suggestion that, oh, I have a friend who knows the king. So it's the distance you are from the king that's measured as the importance of your class too.
Which is also, you know, part of the satire of the play is mocking everyone's use of their closeness to the king as their social currency.
Yeah.
How craven everyone in the play is to this. And Molière had written a couple of other plays which had been banned for their overly direct satire before this. Mm-hmm. So this play was an effort, a successful one, to hide satire of the courtly system in this this comedy of romance.
Yeah, this romance comedy, this romance dilemma as well. And again, a kind of a manners, what will be the manners novel. And I think it's funny because the court system has to play this background role that's vaguely referenced as being a tool for one of the, Orlant, one of the competing characters with Alceste for Célimène's heart. So Orlant, should we move to the scene itself or shall I leave it?
Just want to continue a little bit on this scene. So on the theme that we've been discussing, this misanthropy, Alceste talks about how he hates all mankind because they tolerate wickedness. Because the second part of that moral quandary is, how much can we tolerate the behavior of others when they mistreat another, a third party? Mm-hmm. And he mentions a terrible person, a relation of his who's never in the play, a man who, by the dirtiest jobs, has risen to a splendid position in society. I love how you get this in a lot of 17th, 18th century stuff where somebody's done something terrible, or Wilde actually parodies it in Picture of Dorian Gray, mm-hmm. where Gray's his salacious activities are never explicated, but people are constantly surely you're too beautiful now that I meet you to be the Dorian Gray who is alleged to have done terrible things.
Hidden behind this beauty that he keeps.
But the actual things that he's done are never, you know, in a modern context we would see the character or hear about the character doing something, but it's enough to say, you know, the dirtiest jobs.
Yeah, the words carry so much more meaning.
Could maybe he just owns like a street cleaning company, or maybe he murders for money?
No, because
we don't know.
Because as you said, it's salacious already. It already carries the pertinence of the term. It already carries the meaning of complete crime or something disgusting or vile. Because maybe it doesn't even matter that the specifics in those times didn't matter. It just meant that already they're involved with something that takes them down a notch socially, and that's the part that matters.
He probably has a merchant in his employ,
whipping children or liking someone of a different color. Either way, it's dirty.
Different. I think you're even at this point in history that would have been impossible to even imagine. But Alceste is being sued, and again, we don't hear why he's being sued, but instead of using his influence as this great aristocrat, he has sort of decided he wants to fail in his lawsuit. It means nothing to him anyway to lose a few thousand francs.
A couple thousand more.
So that he'll have this kind of birch to flog the world with.
Yes.
That he'll be able to go, see, everybody's mean. See, even because I'm totally honest. And that we also learn at the end of the scene that he's in love with Célimène, as we mentioned.
Of course, because that's the real conclusion of this anyway. Yeah. That's where his battle is.
And that as Valentine explains to us, I'm surprised you love anyone because you hate everyone, but if you're going to love someone, she is the oddest person because she is renowned for her horrible tongue. In modern terms, she's extremely bitchy, and she's famous for her insincerity. Mm-hmm. And Alceste has to admit that he knows all that. She is quite the nasty girl, but he cannot help but profess his affections.
Yeah, of course, yes. In fact, she's also the embodiment of a lot of the things he just discredited as being the thing he can't handle about Valentine, and can't handle about friends. And yet, it's almost as if maybe he never cared that much before about those extreme human errors, only until he met her, didn't really quite get her, and in the rejection has a reaction formation to hate those things.
I hate everyone else who hates me.
Yeah, exactly, in this socially disgusting way, even though it's not about the social justice or righteousness of it.
We are one to do this, to drag psychoanalytic defense mechanisms in, but it seems appropriate that he is very annoyed with everybody else except for her.
Yeah.
And later on, he, when, well, We'll see.
Look, the trial I think is funny though, because the joke, and this is something that Molière did a lot, which was getting a central character who usually is playing a witty or comedic role, even if there's an underhanded sadness to it, to take something like a trial or an institutional system and reverse it. In this case, the trial is meant to be on Alceste, but Alceste is saying, well, no, I'm going to turn the trial back on them. Humanity will have to justify itself to me based on their merits. In fact, he even says it'll be the honesty of their delivery and how they can try and hold up their supposed crimes against me that will let me know if men are still capable of being just.
So it is the court that is on trial.
Exactly. So he's making it so that, look, if they're unjust with how they deem me, well, then I'll know that it's not a fair system anyway. So he's putting them on trial.
I know I've made this reference before, but I can't resist making it again. There's an episode of The Simpsons where Marge is a teenager and she's going to prom with this creepy guy, and he tries something on, and then she rebukes him, and he's like, look, you can't tell anyone because I'm so well respected in the town that it would hurt the town.
Which is a classic politician kind of remark for going too far.
And in a sense, he's kind of saying that, if I am judged, then it is truly they who have besmirched their reputation because I'm so pure in my sincerity.
Yeah, it's a wonderful defense philosophy that thankfully didn't win with Marge. So the next scene, is it on to the next scene?
It is. Scene two, we meet Arant. Yeah.
Yes, Arant. So Arant is entering the scene, and he meets Alceste in some unknown location. We can assume just...
like all the locations in this.
Unknown, totally, yeah. Just somewhere out in the streets of this French town, possibly Paris even. And he meets him and he says... it goes along the lines of, I've always trusted your candidness and your frankness. And I like your... the way you speak your mind and you're very forthcoming helps with my design of your friendship. So can you read this sonnet I've written? Now, we don't know who the sonnet is for. We can assume it's for Cinema, right? We don't know yet. And Alceste is like, I don't think you want me to read that. And he says, no, please, please. I need the candor right now to know if this is the point of excellence. And you see, Alceste knows that Arant is much more important than him at this point. Arant is essentially some kind of a lord. Is it? I mean, I don't know if they say it, but it's
He's a Marquis. He's another Marquis, but he's a more senior. I think they're all probably Marquises.
He's
somehow, he is good mates with the king.
I think he's closest to the king and the courts as well. He's friends of the court, in fact, I think is what they say.
Yeah, we won't spoil what's happened.
So he's discussing this with them, and again Arant is saying, no, please, I want your criticism no matter what comes forth, just read it and let me know. And he's saying, you don't want that. What you think you want, you don't want. I'm not going to give this to you. And then eventually he just reads it.
There's also in his request though, before he asks for the criticism, he is requesting in again another kind of romantic way, he's formally requesting the friendship of Alceste. He's asking him out as a friend. I've noticed you around. You seem pretty cool.
Apparently you have great wit.
Let's go bowling.
Yeah, exactly.
It's a very formal thing. And he doesn't quite rebuke him, but he says, I don't know you. You could be a lovely guy, or you could be a really annoying guy who eats loudly, deliberately when I'm bowling down the lane, and then, does a little dance when he gets a strike. This is for our American listeners.
Yeah, exactly. It's very specific, actually. So it goes into this funny moment where the sonnet, it's hard to tell in the play because he starts discrediting it already, but it's not quite read out to the audience yet.
He hasn't sold himself very well, though, because Alceste has literally been decrying the falseness and kiss-assery of society, and he does exactly that. Oh, you are so tremendous, And he says, our kingdom contains nothing above the dazzling merit which people discover in you.
I thought that was just him being a sarcastic prick, though.
Oh, no. I think...
there's a lot in this where he is clearly being sarcastic. In fact, later on, Célimène does a very similar thing with her enemy.
No, but this is what Arant says. That's a line from Arant.
Oh, sorry.
Arant comes and lays all of these golden jewels.
It's just a flattery that Alceste
mentioned. And Alceste is kind of quietly boiling to hear. And then he gets to hear this poem, which we can only... I mean, we're hearing it kind of third hand through this... quite old-fashioned translation, so who knows what it sounded like in French, but it's pretty poxy in English.
Yes, completely. But I'm not going to read out that, because you have a quote here from Alceste's reaction, which I also wrote down because I loved it so much, which is, a gentleman ought at all times to exercise a great control over that itch for writing which sometimes attacks us.
We've got it's almost Oscar Wilde, isn't it? It's so pointed and so funny, and You know, if we can pardon the sending into the world of a badly written book, it will only be in those unfortunate men who wrote for their livelihood.
It's beautiful. I really liked it.
It's not your work that it is stained. It's the very act of being bad at writing. You know,
and I also like this idea as well, which completely goes against modern understanding of heuristic or practice to get better at something. He says, if a man is just inherently bad at writing, he should just never write. And I don't know if you have the quote here, but at one point he says, you know, sometimes that's the kind of poem that should be kept in your closet, you know, should be kept away, which I find interesting that he chooses closet as well. But this is brilliant because, I mean, as someone who's tried to and worked with some writing before, and you've obviously done way more than me, I think we can both understand that feeling. There's a superego in even in ourselves makes that judgment of don't do it.
The first thing you read after the first thing you write is the second best thing you've read that day.
Okay.
And but Arant's response is to immediately become indignant. Immediately, oh, how dare you? I'll be fine without your, I shall do very well without your approbation. But then, you know, he says, you know, so show me something you've written if you're so good. And then
I love what he says.
Brilliantly responds, Alceste says, I might perchance make something as bad, but I should take good care not to show them to anyone. It's very like Wilde. It's very like The Importance of Being Earnest. Mm-hmm. You know, it's all of this irony, you know. Oh, it's not, I'm not claiming to be good. Mm-hmm. It's just that if I was as bad as you, I certainly wouldn't show anyone.
It's irony and fantastic rebuttals. Yeah. It's wit. This is where he's actually at his witty moments, because a lot of the times Alceste, as I pointed out, maybe isn't witty. Mm-hmm. I mean, he is witty in his execution. Ultimately, maybe the wit is defined on the language and less on the motivation. But you can tell that his motivations weren't necessarily to make someone laugh. But here he is being witty. He's teasing him, and perhaps because he already knows that Orlanche will later on be possibly a competitor. And it's very, very, it's beautiful.
But it's also his version of politeness. Mm-hmm. This is about as polite as he gets.
As he gets, yeah. And I like that it's a kind of advice. He's saying, look, if I wrote something as shit, which I could do, I just wouldn't show it. So your fault is not even that you wrote it. Your fault is in that you've asked me to see it. And now this is the result of asking me to see it.
How tremendous. We all know this guy. And, you know, whatever art scene you've passed through, this guy who's very talented. And you go up to him and you go, I really like, it happened to me actually a week ago. I was at a poetry reading that I wandered into. And there was a guy and he did a piece and it was very derivative. It was very sort of James Joyce light. Mm-hmm. But surprisingly, you get very little of that because it's quite hard to do. It's pretty hard to be derivative of choice.
Yeah.
So it was very entertaining. And I went up to him to say, you know, to give him, you know, due favor. And he rattled a tin can at me for money and didn't make eye contact and said, "Whoa, I'm directing a film. Give me some money."
Really?
Yeah.
Wow.
So Arantes still exist.
Of course they do. Yeah. I can't tell. Were you the Arant? Or you see the
no, I was the Philant in this.
You're the Philant trying to pay credit.
Trying to be a decent sort.
And it should be mentioned again that Philant is in this scene, or Philantine is trying to kind of keep Alceste's criticism that he can hear coming.
He fires off some wet bandages of praise.
Yeah, some flat, bleeding flattery, wound playing into this kind of systemization of language is nothing more than just like, again, coins or appendages, like this and this. Here's the merit. Give me some merit back.
He rubs the grey back.
Exactly.
Picks a nit from
him. And Alceste slaps him away and says, would you stop with the cloyingness? Go away with that. It's bullshit. Like, he can't handle it. And he's still at that point of being incredibly angry. But it must be remembered that the anger carries through here now from two scenes. And the anger isn't necessarily something you can assume Alceste has been carrying in this way all his life. The anger is coming to a revelation of where this is, where the real problem with honesty lies is coming up. So on to scene three.
I guess you could say that Alceste and Philantine are the Jez and Mark of the 17th century.
Maybe in a way. That's very nice.
It's a stretch.
Very nice. I'm sure Sam Raimi would love that. Neil Armstrong sending their stuff back.
Scene. Scene three is just Alceste saying, Philantine, I've done with your falsity. Sod off.
It's not helping me. So then act two, scene one.
And just to be, the scenes in this play aren't really scenes. Many of them are a few lines long. Anytime a new character enters or leaves, they redefine a scene, which is kind of interesting. But so the acts are more scenes than this, you know, three acts.
That's very true. The act is what changes there. The scenes don't really do anything. Alceste tells Philantine to sod off, as we said. Then act two, scene one is Alceste and his, so he meets with Célimène. And
we get to meet her for the first time. This perfect beauty, this rose that cannot be described in all its glory.
And he starts denigrating all of the suitors who he feels shouldn't be given such admiration from her.
And badgering her.
Yeah, and badgering her and taking her time.
Showing them affection.
And I think at one point he mentions another character, Clitandra, for having a long nail and starts to list, is like, what is it that's pretty about
him? I love
him?
That we actually know a guy who has a long nail as
yeah,
well.
Yeah, we do, yeah. Long thumbnail. It doesn't have a wig, though. And he describes how Clitandra has this, like, is it because of his beautiful wig that he spends so much time rolling? Is it because of the golden emblazons he has on his coat?
And we can imagine that Alceste probably also has a wig. It's just not quite as nice.
Yeah, exactly. He probably has a coat that's perfectly good. It's just not
golden. He has a long nail. It's just not as long.
So again, just to point out to be the golden insignias that are they're mentioned twice in this play. It's another, it's actually quite a Shakespearean trick, which is the robes you wear, the clothes you wear, which in this is all about the masks and the falsities we have to keep up for the ego, let's say, to keep operating on a social level. The gold insignias are things that would represent not just your class, but certain military attributes or certain military accomplishments, as well as possible accomplishments on social levels. So they weren't
Boy Scout badges.
They weren't liberals, okay? This is not a liberal time, but there was still elements of social institutions, and you would get insignias from them. And I'm not going to go naming them all here because we're just going to get into a weird thing where we're going to try and I'll try and break it down. So either way, that was just to point out to people that's what he's complaining about. It's a big thing as well, the robes you wear. If you have golden insignias, that's something to feel competitive for. So he's saying, he's decrying them. He's saying, like, they're meaningless. Is that why you like him? But also we get the sense that Alceste kind of wants to be on that level. Because
you know,
this is Selim's intention.
You could do this. One way to do the play in modern terms would be to do it with kids, which mm-hmm. would be quite nice. But you could also do it with Silicon Valley entrepreneurs.
Oh, you really could.
Because these are people who have everything and yet are ferociously competitive mm-hmm. over the different
the
amount of
that's
everything
left.
That they have.
The only thing that's left, connections to the president and your girlfriend.
The love of a beautiful woman. And in a sense, yeah, Selimine, presumably she is one of the most beautiful women in Paris, in mm-hmm. Paris society. So we are literally talking the Jennifer Lawrence of her day. You know.
Yeah, oh, completely. And
in terms of how she
it.
Would be esteemed. Yeah. And she is quite in love with the idea of being in love.
Completely in love with it, yes. In fact, that's the crucial point here, is her maintenance of it. But let's get into what he was
saying.
She's
also got a lawsuit on the go. It's mentioned briefly, but she again...
Everyone and their mom has a lawsuit in this. It's just a way of having a laugh and getting to the courts.
I thought that was fascinating. I had no idea. You know, I assumed that these would still be dueling times, but no, mm-hmm. it had been replaced by lawsuits.
Well, they haven't been replaced. Dueling still goes on.
It still goes on.
Quite frequently. This is just at this level you don't duel anymore because you wouldn't be so stupid unless it was an academic problem. So if you're going through educational institutes, you'd still... We know the 1800s American Alpha Sigma Epsilon times, but that was a big thing back then too, which is the sorority you belong to, or what they would have called something completely different. That's where you have your duels. So if you're part of a clubhouse where you break the rules of a club member, which is very serious because that's all you had back then as a social contract. You didn't actually have a government who cared if you died. What kept you alive was your friends and their ability to say, well, we'll protect you, much like a mafia. So it was
a
big deal.
The same thing in Ireland as well. At this time, the fraternities in Ireland of students would wander the streets drunkenly, brawling and dueling. And in fact, the famous Queensbury rules of boxing were devised by Lord Queensbury in order that we would have a more civil form of dueling rather than the
awful... very kind of Queensbury. Okay, so she's got a lawsuit on the go, as you're mentioning, which I like the writing of that. She mentions to him that he is the person that she loves, and that, you know, he doesn't need to be jealous apparently because, you know, she just has to keep a certain maintain a certain likeness of everybody. She's saying, don't be so jelly that all these other men, I sometimes give them feedback and I tell them that they have some adorations because that's just what I have to do.
You can't be jealous because I like everyone.
Yeah, I just love everybody.
If there was one other guy, you could be jealous, but I'm just like that.
This
flirty.
This is just who I am. I just flirt, you know, this is just what I do. And why would I ever decry them openly? Why would I publicize that? Which, just to, here we go, putting another peg in our reading plays. This is something that comes up again. So this is another Nafric thing, which is her inability to commit to saying what she truly feels mm-hmm. about anybody in their presence because she's frightened of losing any sustained connection with these people, because every connection is another a franc, another 10,000 francs, another thing you can say that you have as a powerful friend group to be connected with the king or just to be a woman with potential. And I think that's probably Selimine's biggest problem. She wants to live in potentiality without necessarily committing to anything.
Don't we all? The 100 euro in the bank account is worth far more than the 100 euro you've just spent
exactly.
on a box set of This American Life.
Wow. Is that what happened?
No.
Yeah, because I don't think there even is a box set.
I don't think I could afford one if there was.
Oh, I'd love that.
But this is, in modern terms, this scene and these early scenes, they come across as very abusive. Alceste, and throughout this play, Alceste is, you know, to be anachronistic, he's being really pushy and controlling, mm-hmm. And yet he's kind of borne out as relatively noble towards the end of the play. But poor Selimine doesn't have a lot of options.
Yeah.
Here. And as you said, she's living the potentiality because that's all she has. Once she marries, she will be still noble and all the rest, but she won't have any more opportunity to socialize beyond whatever her husband allows.
All the male suitor friends will go, all the presence, the fun, the chiming, the energy that comes with being flirtatious, the chemistry that exists in being in some form living through Eros, the delay, being sexually active, but not in the sense of having sex, but talking, flirting, enjoying the energy. She's going to lose all of that. And what girl at that peak moment of 20 when she's at her most beautiful wouldn't want to maintain that or keep hold of it? I mean, it's quite tragic in that sense that she's, you know, clinging on to something that I'm sure a lot of people feel they have to cling on to today. And this is where the other character, Rizno, comes in as this more jealous. She's also super jelly and condescending character who is known to be prudish and keeping a shitty home, but they never make references to what specifically is bad about her home. And she's, the future echo, the thing later on, the older version of what, of what Selimane will be. And she's basically saying, look, I've had that once. And there's a sense that she definitely had what Selimane once had, but just things of, you know, she's aged, time's moved on. And age is the big killer here. You know, this is the thing that's really frightening. Probably motivates Selimane to do what she's doing, which is kind of keep this movement going, because age is critical. Like, this is not a time where you can...
I was flippant earlier. People did live into old age, but of course, this is a time when you could get cholera, or you could get TB or something, and you would get very ill and pass away very quickly. And
Arisno's handsomeness is gone because of her age. They say it. So this is something that's terrifying to her. So as much as we don't like
her, she's 21. She's an old maid.
Yeah, she's gone, you know.
But it's funny, it's hard to conceive of in contemporary terms, but when you look at portraits from this era, or even, you know, from the 1930s or 40s, people did look a lot older than they do now at the age, and they physiologically seemed much older. A woman of 30 looked like the equivalent of 50 today, literally. And that ties in with the lifespan that they often had. And the food, even though it would have been very rich, wouldn't have been healthy. And this is the lead paint era as well, the lead face paint era, rather, where you're caking on your white powder and it's killing you.
Yeah.
So all of these things are going on. This is a fragile time, even for the most privileged. None of this referred to explicitly, but it's all in the mix.
It's written into its time. It's something that would have been self-evident or implicit then.
So we have a few brief scenes then later in this act where Alceste arrives to visit Selimane, and he interrupts another suitor, and you know he gives out to her again. Why is this guy here? And Clitandre arrives.
Yes.
And Alceste runs away. So we more kind of controlling and impetuous kind of childishness by Alceste,
yeah,
running off,
but inveighing himself onto the situation. But there's an honesty. He's keeping emotionally honest, as established at the start, but this time we're getting a very clear idea that when they're saying he's being a bit mad, it is getting onto an irate, maybe irrational level of anger. But I think at this point the audience would still maintain that there's something he wants out of this, and maybe she does deserve him an answer, or he deserves an answer from her. There's something that needs to be claimed here.
Okay, so then we get to this afternoon tea type situation with all the suitors. So these scenes all kind of run together. It's just the way the play is written. It's hard to look at them as individual scenes because they're often so brief, and they don't have a kind of classical scene arc with character development in the same way as you get in later theatre. We're still at a point where the scenes exist in order that things must happen for the play to proceed in a very self-evident way.
Mm-hmm.
But we get the first demand from Alceste that Selimane pick someone, choose a suitor. I'm fine if it's not me, but pick someone.
Yeah.
You know, which is, in modern terms, it's a great imposition. I don't think we're supposed to think that way, but to read it today is to see someone who is imposing on someone else. And he says later in the play, you can't force your heart onto another, or, you know, the heart must choose. But that's not how he behaves.
Not at all.
He behaves as though he can force her to like him.
Yeah, no, he's giving her an ultimatum. And with great askance, he's pushing onto her the ultimatum of himself, which, while he doesn't necessarily value himself very highly, he does want to take her with him. And in some way, I'm sure she admires him, or she wants some of his attention, taking himself out of the picture as if he's... So I guess he does value himself very highly, but perhaps in a way that's a little bit schizophrenic. He's trying to say, I'm going to leave if you don't do this, which is a very unfair thing to do if there ever was an actual chemistry of friendship there to behold.
It's classic emotional manipulation.
Yeah.
It's a red flag.
He's
probably going to smack her around if they do end up together.
Absolutely. You know, because the guy is highly controlling.
He is an angry man.
Yes.
So this is in these kind of scene 5 and 6 in Act 2, we get this first kind of vision of Selimane's wit as she talks about, I love how she describes them, originals in society.
Yeah.
The misfits, various suitors and other people that they know. She entertains her two most wealthy and influential suitors by insulting all of her other suitors.
Mm-hmm.
And she describes people as... she says about one guy, since he took it into his head to be clever, he's so difficult to please that nothing suits his taste. Which and then
I did like that as well. Took it into his head to be clever.
Yeah, and so someone says they're talking about another guy, and he says, "Well, everyone says he." To be fair to him, one of her suitors says, "To be fair to him, you know, he throws a magnificent platter together. He always gets some good grub when you're in his house." And she says, "His foolish person is a very bad dish."
Yeah. She goes on to say, if you could just remove something like his bald place, or if you could remove his bald person from the table, if you could remove that from the menu, it would be even better. So it's like, the food's great. He just doesn't need to be there because I can't stand him.
So in a sense, these two are even more mirrored, Salamine and Alceste, because they both have this kind of really cruel wit. I think she more enjoys it and uses it as a social tool, and he's unintentional with it. We're just trying to be polite in his really mean way. But they're both really bitchy and really good at putting people in their place. So you can conceive of a sense in which they could make a power couple, you know, just tearing everyone down over drinks, you know.
Yeah. I mean, that's just a good way of putting it. There's a problem, though, that exists here, that with her, she's sharing a lot of his language. She criticizes on similar levels and also can see through the kind of, let's call it, the profundities and perfunctory natures of symbols. Like, he puts on a good grub, but he's still a kind of particularly boorish person. One person thinks he's more intelligent than he is, which stifles conversation. These are real complaints that you could hear from people, also from someone who's clearly quite intuitive, as well as a well-spoken woman of English, or in this case, French, who's intelligent enough to detect these things. The problem more lies in her demonstrating that she knows all this about the other suitors in front of the two suitors who are with her. She's also letting us know reflexively that this is something she does with them when they're not in the room.
Yeah.
This is how she feels about everybody.
The classic friend that you have that bitches about everybody. You're like, what do you say about me when I'm not
exactly
here?
What happens when I leave the room?
And this is what's going to come back and bite her in her perfectly formed behind.
Mm-hmm.
So that we get in these scenes, you get Alceste and her other suitor sycophantically going, "Oh, you're so witty and brilliant in your..."
Yeah.
Not Alceste, the other two guys.
Yeah, because he wouldn't give credit. Yes.
He wouldn't. So, and Alceste says, you know, he says, "You're hypocrites. You know, here she is, you know, saying horrible things about people you shouldn't." And they say, "Well, if you like her, why don't you find her perfect?" And he says, the more we love anyone, the less we ought to flatter her.
I love that, yes.
And then
that's a fantastic line.
"Were I a lady, I would banish all those mean-spirited lovers who submit to all my sentiments and whose mild complacencies every moment offer up incense to my vagaries." So I've written here underneath, if I was a chick, I'd date nerds.
Date nerds, exactly. I would go to this particular kind of person that I know I am. I play to the flaws of me. And what I loved as well is because there was a quote you didn't quite spell. I mean, like, you deliberately didn't just read the whole of it. But what I loved is the next line after, "The more we love anyone, the less we ought to flatter her. True love shows itself by overlooking nothing," which I quite liked. The idea that for him to love someone is to criticize everything, is to see all of the flaws. And this is something that Elant, the nicer, more fairer of the ladies, says to him, "Actually, that's not quite true. Language, in the way we use it, is transformed such that the flaws that we see actually become the perfections that we take virtue in." So this is where the idea, and this is something we didn't bring up at the start, big theme in this is virtue. What is virtue? Where does it come from? Where do you spell it? Is it something we carry in the way we talk to one another? Is it something we create in the moment? Where ought it to be? That kind of thing. Like, where ought it from? And Elant is saying, "Well, you're wrong a bit there, Alceste, because you're saying that this, if you're highly critical of someone, it means you see everything about them." But the problem here is the tone of criticism. And she's trying to say, well, what if the tone is that the things you see as critical are actually wonderful? What if that's the very aspect of love in its wholeness? That's a really interesting thing, because I didn't expect Molière to throw in someone to actually come up with a pretty decent critical response to what has been so far the witty contrarianism. And I really liked that, because it goes to show that there's some heart, at least as far as the Fair Lady goes.
Yeah, and Elant is this kind of this wise girl who's demonstrating a humility we haven't seen in the other characters. Valentin is not an ignoble person, but he's a cynical one, and
Allant kind of is an in-between place, and it's kind of reminiscent of that Shakespeare sonnet, Sonnet 130, where he lists off the faults of his lovers, and yet he swears his love is rare as any she belied with false compare. Because it's not that you don't see what's wrong, it's that because you love them, it is the ordinary and the ugly become beautiful, and it erases the faults. You don't not see them, but they're no longer faults.
Yeah.
And then Allant is arrested.
Mm-hmm.
Over his earlier poetry criticism.
Yeah.
Which is great.
Well, it's not that he's arrested, he's summoned with a threat of arrest.
Summoned by the marshals.
Because that distinction is so important.
You're coming down the station because you just have to put the
cuffs on. Oh, yeah, it's not really. Like, just can you arrest yourself for me there? He's told to go visit the courts because Orlant is apparently throwing a shit fit somewhere out there with his court friend, saying, I can't believe he criticizes poetry. Get him in here and put him down for some social crime. So he's being brought up, and he's saying, though, he's made a commitment at the start of the scene we didn't mention, which he committed to Selimane that he's going to stay and watch her with all her suitors and not leave.
Immediately leave.
Yeah, and now he's being forced to leave with his arrest, but he's saying, but I don't want to leave. He's telling his butler who tells him, early on it's someone else. And he's saying, it's the guard, I think.
Mm-hmm.
And then he's saying to the guard, like, no, I'm not leaving. I made a commitment to stalk the shit out of this girl, and make sure she's totally not bailing on me.
It's funny because it's not really coming across because we're focusing selectively on the interesting dialogue and so on, but really comes through when you read the play that his love for her, if love it be, is extraordinarily possessive, and in modern terms you would consider him someone possibly quite dangerous even.
Yes,
he's very, very angry, and he's very, very determined that she be honest in exactly the kind of way that he wants her to be.
Mm-hmm.
Because presumably he is also 20, although he could be 40 something,
he could be 60, wouldn't matter at this point.
When Moliere married his alleged daughter, he was in his late 40s and she was 20, and it was very scandalous at the time.
Okay,
I don't know if it was the age gap or the fact that it was probably his daughter, but it was,
but it could be a bit of both,
a bit of a Woody Allen Sunny situation.
Yeah, comorbid. One makes the other worse. It is a bit of a Woody Allen situation. I was thinking that when you said earlier about the Woody Allen situation. Of course, he didn't actually give birth to her, but that's another time.
Well, no man has ever actually given birth, James.
Yeah. Oh my God. I know, right?
We're going to be pedantic.
We're so tired. Yeah.
So the next scene is the clitandre, clitoris, and...
Yeah, okay, just say it.
And a cast.
We're all thinking.
Discussing their affections for Selimane.
Yes.
And they have a sort of a... I wrote down here, it's a cast is kind of a 17th century rapper. So they sort of have a rap battle here where they wittily defend each other's affections for Selimane and positive characteristics. So the exchange kind of goes like this. Clitandre says, you flatter yourself, dear friend, mm-hmm. and are altogether self-deceived. And Acast says, it's true, I flatter myself, and I am, in fact, altogether self-deceived. And Clitandre says, well, but what causes you to judge your happiness to be complete? And Acast says, well, I flatter myself. Upon what do you ground your belief? I'm altogether self-deceived.
Yeah.
So he's just like, yeah, I got nothing going on.
Yeah,
I'm just nobody.
But it's immediate contradiction, and that's why it's a very Wildean thing to do, which is to establish something very quickly with an esteem, something with an authority, something almost providentially consistent, which is I am the king, or in this case, I'm the Marquis, I'm young, everything's going for me. And then immediately his friend Clitandre starts saying, well, is that quite true? Yeah. And he's like, nah.
Not sure.
I'm totally self-deceived. And then he keeps saying, like, are you sure you can even get this woman? I mean, why are you so obsessed with her anyway? I'm self-deceived. Just go with it.
it's very similar to the opening scene of The Importance of Being Earnest, when we get this great dialogue between the two variously cynical men with their stratagems, mm-hmm. Who are kind of self-abnegating falsely while being incredibly arrogant. And he does have this great page of his where it's just an entire page of great things that are great about him. Acast, he's noble, he's a good critic, brave, handsome, a snappy dresser, women love him, he's friends with the king.
Uh-huh.
And Clitandre says, well, how do you know? You know she likes you. And he says, well, I'm not the kind of man who'd be attracted to a woman who didn't fancy me.
Yeah, exactly.
I'm not some poor sap who's going to try and convince her. No, I'm just here to give her the chance to tell me how great I am.
Mm-hmm. But then it's Clitandre immediately reveals that I don't think she actually does find you suitable. I mean, she seems to insult you almost consistently. How do you take the insults? And then he starts to it's very interesting because what he does is, I think Clitandre, it's again Wildean, he takes in the very things that this person said is great about himself and then uses them against him, which is like, are you sure that's what it is? In this case, it's like, Are you sure it's a connection with the king? I don't think she cares. She tends to make jokes about you. I don't think that's what it is.
The great thing about having society this polite is that you get insults so nuanced.
Yeah.
You know, you can't just come right out and say you're an arrogant jerk. You have to say, you know, your pride is a magnificent thing, sir. Everything is ironic.
Yeah. Everything's a caveat and attachment as well, because you repeat what they say. It's like, well, it's right. You do have a mighty and bellows-worthy robe, but you're also a bit of an asshole. Like, you have to attach everything, because they tend to be very performative here, just to put that down. In language here, it's very performance-based, regardless of the play. And if you're saying something nice, or even if you're saying something discrediting, you always have to make sure the first thing you say is flattery anyway. Mm. So even though you're intending to be nice, you kind of open with being flattering.
And which is all part of this very codified politeness. That the fact let me look at my page of names. The fact that Alceste has been taken into custody almost for this poetry criticism is not an aberration. It's not only because Arendt is so close to the king. It seems to be that this is a society where insult to reputation is a very serious thing, and very so you have to be very careful when you insult someone. So here we have two characters, Selamine and Alceste, who are incautious with their insults, and both suffer for it, as we see.
Mm-hmm.
So moving on.
Yes, okay, so
Arsinoe arrives, the girl who's been described as prudish.
Arsinoe, or Arisno, it has to be Arsinoe, doesn't it? I keep trying to pronounce it in a better way.
Arsinoe.
Yeah, Arsinoe. I see what I'm trying to do. I'm also trying to move the I. I'm trying to change the letters to form a better and more easily read name. So the prudish girl, she shows up, and she opens again, like I mentioned, with this long, somewhat prevaricated expository on, you know how much I take you as a friend, and I come to you only as a friend to tell you about the friendly thing that I'm going to tell you, which is that maybe two people who are of the utmost virtue, because everyone they quote, every gossip group they're making reference to always has to be the most virtuous, because they're aware that if their gossip circle isn't mentioned that way, it could just be a gossip circle, which is what it is.
So this is a classic bitchy exchange in all of literature.
We're totally, it's like me saying to you, Gareth, like, I come to you as the most intelligent man in this field that I know, and fully aware of the great projects you've done. But a great friend of high merit said that you're a bit of a dick. Like, it's basically what it is.
Which I, of course, would never say.
Which I would say.
But I've heard it so many times
now.
And
I had to take it to your court immediately as your friend.
Yeah.
It's like that.
And before she arrives, as the suitors are leaving, Selamine says, you know, they say, oh, the prudish girl. And she says, oh, she's not prudish. She's only jealous of those less wretched than her and with less feeble charms and more successful in love. She's using her prudishness as a defense against her isolation. Which is one, this is really sophisticated stuff. So. Mm-hmm. So she's being incredibly, incredibly cruel. It's very like Jane Austen in the sense that something that people perceive as a positive characteristic. You know, she's only really chaste because, you know, she'd be chased out of her village if she wasn't, kind of thing. That's terrible. Apologies for that.
No, it's fantastic.
So they have this bitchy exchange.
So it's a back and forth that starts with Arisinoe or Arsinoe, and she's saying this like, well, you know, I've just heard from these two people, and they say that, you know, to take a term that you used earlier, Gareth, coquettish, in your coquettish ways, you're just very fond of a lot of suitors. Is that true? To which, you know, Selamine is brilliantly able to kind of come back and turn it back in her face again, using irony the way we've seen before, which is to say, well, one of my definite friends who I hold close to my circles, and I feel great about you. But from my own gossip circle, or actually what it is, from a couple of people I've heard who have high merit instead of virtue this time, they said that, you know, you're incredibly prudish to defend the fact that your family is shit, and that you're getting a bit old, and that you deliberately take on the problems of others, even though you judge righteously, and it's a bit hypocritical.
And she throws in just kind of randomly that you beat your servants and don't pay them.
Exactly,
which is, which is what, like, and which is never responded to. Arsinoe doesn't go, how dare you?
Yeah, well, that's obviously true.
I mean, it's beneath contempt. How would you, is that an insult? Everyone beats their servants.
So yeah, like, come on, just get away with
pay
that.
Pay them. What are you, consider me a fool to waste my money on servants? Selamine has a great line here, which it's kind of one of these great bon mots that are dropped throughout the play. She says, it's easy to blame or praise everything, and everyone may be right according to their age and taste,
mm-hmm.
which is just saying, you know, everything's relative.
Yeah.
And in a sense, she's held up as kind of a villain in the play, but it's a great, I think it's a great attitude, you know, everything and everyone may be right according to their taste and age. You know, maybe I'm just more mature than you. Maybe actually, well, she's putting it the other way. She's like, you know, you're a lot more mature than me. Someone of your age, of course, would see things this way. But, mm-hmm. you know, 20 is not an age to play the prude.
Exactly. It's not the time to stand back and make such apparent moral judgments.
You're absolutely right. That's where you learn she's 20, which I'd forgotten.
Which I to go on to, I don't know if you've already made this quote, but I quite like it, which is when she's discrediting Arsinoe, she's saying to save her feeble charms, she brands as criminal the power which they lack, which I really, I love that line there, because, I mean, first of all, Selimane is able to show very quickly, and almost probably through instinct by seeing a bit of herself in this woman, what her greatest weakness is, which of course is her ugliness and trying to hide her ugliness. Now, she's not really ugly, but she's ugly enough that she's not as powerful as Selimane. And Selimane probably represents a similar point in society that this woman's at, but this woman has gone past that point and is stuck with the family. And there's a jealousy inherent here in the potentiality that one still has, clings on to and has, and what the other one, you know, clamors for in the past, but has long since gone. And she's able to, in that differentiation, judge this woman very quickly. She's able to acutely stab her where it hurts. She's saying, your charms once were functioning and they were great, but now you're trying to hide them and the tricks aren't working.
And Arsinoe responds by saying, well, it's very easy to judge at what price they may be attracted nowadays. I love that. Like, you know, these days you got to put out, which you're clearly doing. Even though putting out is probably just holding someone's hand.
No, it means writing a letter. That's all it means. It turns out it's letter writing.
True. Yes, it's a epistolary dalliance. So Arsinoe is incredibly insulted and by Selimane's thrusting wit, and she's about to storm off when Alceste arrives, and Selimane's like, "Oh, you guys can entertain each other, you pair of dicks. Like, you guys are
perfect
good
for one another."
Which is appropriate because Arsinoe, of course, is another person who's in love with Alceste. And that's one of the reasons that she's really there, is to say, you know, Selimane, stay away from my man. You know, please don't love him just because he can.
Yeah, exactly. And so putting him out there, like, I still have control over him, but you can play with him.
If she knew Jolene any better, then she'd know that's
not going to happen.
That's catnip right there.
Exactly.
Oh, you like him? Okay, I like him now.
Yeah, all over him.
Again, it makes so much more sense if they're 10, you know?
Yeah, completely. Which is making something desirable by others' wants of it, which is very funny. I don't desire this anymore. Oh, people like it again? I want it now. It's a very good sub-routine, and this is the adulthood that's coming in. The ability to control that as well is probably the only real currency that's important here. Now we move on where Arsinoe is left with Alceste, and she immediately starts crediting Alceste, this time using similar language to what was being given to deliver to Selimane. But instead of saying, I'm your great friend, but I've heard people saying bad things about you, she's saying, I've heard people say that you're a very witty person, that you're of great interest. And we get the sense then that most of the time when they're making reference to an outside gossip group, it's just not psychological coaching, but they're making it up completely. It is just whatever serves that point of flattery to get what they want, which is, I am, you know, interested in you, Alceste.
And little does she know that the last thing that this guy wants is someone to flatter him.
Which
he really needs to be treated mean.
Yeah, which is how he likes to be treated by something he loves, or at least how he takes love. So he discredits this and says, look, I don't care who's flattering me. Like, everyone blows smoke these days. That's actually a quote, I think. And he's like, this is something that gets done. It means nothing to me. The same kind of, it's kind of a bringing back up, it's recrudescence of the argument that Philantine had at the start with him, which is, it's no point trying to do this. It's not going to work with me. And he kind of tries to storm off almost because he just gets bored with her in seconds. And she then starts saying, well, I didn't mean to necessarily be flattery, and maybe I meant it as something else.
And she hints that she has a MacGuffin. Some evidence that Selimane is not as chaste. Her hand has betrayed her chastity with something.
Yes, he's
an evidence.
Perhaps she's unworthy of holding the heart, I think is what it is. And this evidence is hinted at, and the bargain is, walk home with me, I think, isn't it?
It's like, walk home with me and I'll show you. I've got some evidence underneath my bed.
And dress, a bit of both. So walk with me and I'll let you know. And then they go off.
Which is interesting stage. That they're, despite this incredibly courtly and restrictive sexual politics, that they can be alone together. A man and a woman can be alone together. And there's no mention of in the similar period of British aristocracy, you'd have to have a chaperone of some sort.
Yeah, of course.
But presumably, it's unimaginable that they would ever.
It's odd, isn't it, that they can be alone together and not rip each other's clothes off immediately or just get straight to it? Like, that's
the haven't they seen Jersey Shore?
Can never leave them alone.
I suppose Alceste is kind of the situation of the misanthrope.
How do you mean?
Yeah, the situation in Jersey Shore. The guy pulls his shirt up.
Wow. That's didn't even think. How can you think about things like that? I'm just not a Jersey Shore guy. Maybe that's
just not a Jersey Shore
yeah,
guy.
Yeah, that's my problem is.
So they run off into the sunset.
Come to my gaff as you write it. I love that. Yeah,
come to my gaff and I'll show you the evidence. Act four. We get Eliant and Philantine discussing the trial of Alceste. He refused to apologize for slagging off the poetry, and he lost the trial.
Mm-hmm.
He said in the case, if one has not the gift of composing better, one ought to leave off rhyming altogether, which itself rhymes, even in the translation, unless condemned to it on forfeit of one's life. Write a poem and kick the shit out of
you. Exactly. So unless you're going to die and you have to write a poem, don't do it.
And then the magistrate forced them to embrace is how it's that. I love that court. Like, you're in poetry court. And the
hug it out, bitch.
Hug it out. Oh, burn.
Look at them go as the magistrates hide their latent homosexuality.
That's all Oront wanted was to have a nice hug from the man he so respected. If he'd given him a hug in the first place, instead of going on about false embraces, and it would have been fine.
In the better aspects of postmodernism, as well as the much sometimes funnier, ironic writing of comedy today, you look at Zoolander, and maybe you don't like that film, but I always enjoy that moment where the two antagonists, which is Derek Zoolander and his opposite played by Owen Wilson, who I can't remember who he is, Hansel, when they finally meet, and this is the moment they reveal each other's hates for one another, which is like, you know, okay, you guys have to figure it out. It just comes down to, why are you acting so messed up towards me? After they've manipulated like whole fashion chains against each other, it's like, well, why are you acting so messed up towards me? So I like this idea that it just comes down to he needs a hug, or it's really that he didn't take his friendship. He's making it such a high courtly thing.
But this is also kind of tying into the original theme of how you should treat the world. If we think of the nobility in France in the 17th century as being kind of like celebrities or media personalities in a way, this is something that happens, and Marc Maron talks about it all the time, resentments between comedians who last for years, and he said, she said, and it's literally like schoolroom kind of stuff,
yeah,
where one person maybe thinks the other person
it pervades and it persists.
Yeah, they think the other person's giving them a cold shoulder because they're not quite famous enough, and then the other person picks up on the resentment and they're like, well, he's kind of being a jerk,
and the reactance causes it to get worse. Yeah.
And this is the kind of politics that still exists, and you know, Maron is very open about it. That's his particular neurotic spin, is that he tells everyone. Mm-hmm. And you know, he interviewed Tim and Eric on the show last week, and they made a joke out of it, but the joke was that he was like, I always kind of thought you guys were ironic and not really funny, and I could tell you didn't respect me. And they're like, yeah we could tell you were a dick. And there's a bit where Tim Heidegger says to him, you know, yeah, I did see you at that premiere, and I didn't think you were famous enough to talk to.
Wow.
And you know, it's all part of the meta joke, but it's not a joke, really. Yeah. And this is the world that these people live in. So this bitchiness is all, as you said, it's related to power, and it's related to who is closest to the king and whether you even need to. If you're doing really well on YouTube, maybe you don't need to be friendly to the guy on TV, you know, exactly. I got my own audience.
Just to say that friendliness is not at all a virtue that was carried out by feeling, but carried out by nothing more than the need for power or a connection that was to be established as a transaction to get something. And that's the problem. So where's the virtue going to lie in this? I was going to focus more on how Eliant and Philantine are at least characters in this play, while not necessarily being the nicest of people, come across as the most virtuous. So even though both at different points have maintained that lying to a certain extent or hypocrisy is okay, because of what they do and how they act out, which is one to protect a friend and the other one to protect her cousin, as well as to show her love for man but reserve it in favour for another potential, we get the sense that they're the only people who do any good.
Right, yeah. And that's another commentary in the play, is that, you know, at this point in history, presumably, you certainly would have had or very, very close to it, courtly virtues and knightly virtues would have been taken quite literally. At the same time, is not obeyed at all or extant in reality. You know, only the Crusades were quite recent at this point in history. So horrible inhumanity to man, but with this virtuous myth. And as we see here, the people who are the most virtuous are the ones who are at least slightly pragmatic and take others into account and aren't entirely trying to accord to some impossible ideal, and slaying the Muslim left, right and centre.
Yeah, they've broken that kind of ignorant, again, smuggish 13-year-old, I've yet to commit to life, but I can definitely control and watch all of it, objective idea of total non-hypocrisy or never you know, saying something that is a lie. So they've broken Alceste's rules of being somewhat true to one's statements or words, but in their doing, they're much more virtuous than him. in what they actually try and do, they ultimately provide, they've compromised themselves, but the compromise is part of living. And in that compromise, they seem to be better people. In fact, we're going towards an ending I can't spoil, but that's part of why this play goes the way it goes.
Spoilers.
Yes.
You might have missed season one 400 years ago.
Yeah. Spoilers for this entire play. Yeah, it is a bit ridiculous, 1666, but it's more than many of them probably, or some listeners might not have read it.
So to get back to where are we in the story? So
Alceste arrives after... Well, no, actually, we should explain. If Valente or Valente and Elante, it's just a little bit differently written here, are discussing this trial. And we know that the magistrates kind of made them hug Orlante and Alceste and favoured against favoured for Orlante and against Alceste. And the way it's discussed, Valente is trying to explain to Elante, look, he would not budge. Alceste would just not give them what they wanted, which is he just had to concede his words, and he wouldn't. He would stay true to himself. But there also is a sense of exchange going on where the magistrate and him are finding new ways to say his insults, to try and bring it down, deflate it a little bit. So they're aware he won't budge because he wants to hold his power of his words. But in some way, he also knows they have the power to arrest him. So he's trying to budge. So there's this funny way in which Valente describes it as, okay, so they kind of brought it down to this. He said at first it was he should never write again. And then he brought it down to, well, he credited him as a gentleman. So we get the sense that he was actually kind of compromising his statement with the magistrate.
He said a lot of things he didn't know. He said, oh, of course he's a fine gentleman and he's noble and everything. Yeah. He doesn't know all that stuff. And that's exactly what he was saying at the start when he refused to declare his friendship for him, because he said, I don't know you from Adam, you could be anything. And and here he's had to backtrack and become a bit more pragmatic, making him far more of a hypocrite than Elante or Valentine.
Yeah.
So at this point, Elante mentions that she too is attracted to Alceste despite his eccentricity. And Valente says, I can't believe he likes anyone, least of all Selamine. But, you know, I quite like you. And if it doesn't work out for you two,
yeah,
I'm,
but it's also really sad how he says it. He says, like, if you could see those same things transferred to me. Yeah.
There's a lot of those things. A lot of, you know, I know I'm a vile wretch unworthy of your affections, but if you could deign to step on my face, it would be...
With a heel. Yeah. You don't even have to look at me. In fact, it's better if you don't.
That's quite into that, you know. So Alceste arrives brokenhearted because Arsinoe has given him a letter, supposedly from Orant. Mm-hmm. For Orant, to Orant, from Selamine, which is, you know, affectionate. So he says, oh, Elante, take me, look, forget. And she says, well, no, you're gonna change your mind in like 10 minutes.
Yeah.
You're like offering me your hand and you fancy this other person. That's ridiculous. Mm-hmm. And then Selamine approaches and Alceste promises, in my favourite line of the play, to put her to the blush.
Yeah.
I'm going to have to use that at some point. Have you no shame? I'll put you to the blush.
I think the modern day Dublinese people call it scarlet. Or scarlet.
Scarlet if you're mafia, haven't you?
Exactly. That's the line. Please don't ever say it again. So Alceste, he's saying, look, I think the quote you have here as well, neither fate, hell nor heaven in its wrath ever produced anything so wicked as you are.
So this guy is
slamming her now.
King of hyperbole. Yeah, like the worst thing has ever been done in the world. There's no entertaining a heart by force. Every soul is free to name its conqueror. But you're humiliating deceit. Yeah. It's not that you don't like me. Mm-hmm. It's that you would be so dishonest as not to tell me.
Exactly.
You can imagine a guy, a 19-year-old guy berating a girl in the pub. It's, I know you don't fancy, but you should have told me you don't fancy.
Exactly. Yeah. So it's more that like his problem, again, being sublimated or switched around, is that she reigns with impunity her feelings and emotions in a way that are private or hidden or not quite laid
How
out.
How dare she not be
impunity
perfectly
insofar
honest.
As that he's being too punitive with ridiculous standards that everyone has proven they can't live by. So he's saying, well, why couldn't you just be more honest about it, or at least if their affections were for me and also for others, let me know of who's on the field, like the idea of like why weren't they out there. And he brings in God and man, he goes really philosophical about it. He's very eruditious, he's being at his most erudite right now, and the attempt is to try and, he's angry, he's conveying that, which is true, but he's also trying to maintain intellect, and he's also trying to get wit in to attack her. So he's working on three levels, the way I see it, in conversation, in this long, somewhat soliloquied, prognosticized statements, which is, I'm hitting you, I'm attacking you, like, give me something, which I read in the modern context of just trying to force someone to give any emotion back because you're desperate for your investment to show some sort of gold, you're desperate for the claim to show color. Yeah. Show me color.
This is a guy who'd be as happy with an angry rejection as an acceptance. He just wants some heart to it.
Yeah.
And she's so brilliant. Like, I love this character Selamine. She's the best character in the play for me.
Yeah.
She said, oh, well, that letter where I talk about how much I love you, that's for a woman. Mm-hmm. Yeah, that was for a girl. You can't be jealous. Mm-hmm. And he's like, oh, damn you, I know it's not true, but I have to accept that it might be true because you're so incredible. He describes himself as having excessive, astonishing, fatal love your treacherous looks have inspired.
Oh, the exceeding love.
I feel the same way about Jennifer Lawrence.
Yeah, well, come on, Jennifer Lawrence.
When they find me in the woods behind her Beverly Hills apartment.
You mean the Erotomaniac cops, especially hired to find you.
I can't be blamed for this bear costume.
She looked at me
through the screen.
through the tinted limo glass. Somehow I knew she looked at me.
It's like a Cronenberg, in a Cronenberg movie, some crazed fan.
Quake, you know, or Shutter, whatever that's called.
He has a new movie out, which I have seen by illegally downloading it. Mm-hmm. And it's not a great film, but there's some great lines in it. And it's about this kind of bizarre pursuit that people do in Hollywood. And there's a line in it where someone says, you know, for a disfigured schizophrenic, you sure got a lot of hookups in this town.
Jesus. All right, I got to check that. What's that called, actually, just so you promote it?
IMDb will tell you.
Okay, I'll find the new Cronenberg.
It's got the guy from Twilight. Big chin
it.
From Twilight, isn't it?
Oh, really?
It's very similar to his last couple of movies. It's just contemporary Hollywood surreal satire with a bit of a few magical things.
They Live and stuff like that is when he's been like,
nothing like that.
Yeah, that's nothing. Only been my like the classics for me are his favorite. We're not Shutter, whatever the one where they're in the hotel and everyone's going sex mate crazy, and there's stuff in the sinks. What's that one again?
I don't.
And know. It's shot on two floors of an old hotel that's out in the middle of nowhere in the British countryside.
Have you seen? What's the classic one? Videodrome.
Yes,
that's incredible.
I really enjoyed that. Really, yeah, good. Yeah. And I don't usually like James Spader in anything.
Nobody does.
Yeah. Not James Spader. James Woods.
Oh, I like James Woods. But James Spader, on the other hand, I could do without.
No, I quite like him even better than James Woods. James Woods was just doing his character acting role. Look, we'll get into this another time, but Videodrome.
This is in our other show, Watching Movies.
How to Like Cronenberg. I just said his name really
quickly. Cronenberg. Damn you, Cronenberg. You stole my lunch money. So back and forth of this letter, this Selamine's betrayal, and I can't get over his feelings, and... So what happens then? He's still trying to get her to own up to it. And she's kind of like, yeah, okay, it is for someone else. Yeah, so what? What are you going to do? And then his servant arrives, Alceste's servant, and he demonstrates his hypocrisy. You know, all this, you know, true noble virtues and everything. And he says, I shall knock you on the head to a certainty, Bobby. Or Booby.
Booby, yes.
Booby, if you do not explain yourself more clearly. Listen, Booby. Booby is used a couple of times.
Yeah. I didn't look much into it, really.
I don't know. It's just
let it slide
it's
by.
It's so childish, you know. And some letter has arrived. Oh, there's going to be some more trouble for you, Alceste. But the damn Booby left the letter at home and forgot to bring it with him. It's a kind of classic servant falling over his own uniform comedy fashion.
There is kind of what Tubbsy Malone to it. Or not Tubbsy Malone. What's it called? You know, the Bugsy Malone kids playing with guns aspect. Yeah. Only because the way you said booby. It's kind of very like 30s dame speak kind of stuff.
So on to our next act. Alceste has lost his case with Arendt and he has to pay 20,000 francs. And worse, he's been accused of publishing a terrible book. So he's decided he's going to Walden it. He's going to Galtgulch it. He's going to leave this cesspool of humanity behind and go live on his own and be a true intellectual.
To leave the jungle, as he puts it, which is interesting because he's leaving humanity for somewhere that you would consider to be returning to the woods, the jungle of men's great ancestral...
A smaller castle.
You know, prehistoric fortitude. But apparently in this case, it's just he's leaving the Parisian or possibly French... societal jungle, as he puts it, like a place he calls it iniquity, a place of iniquity and competition and hypocrisy, and he's leaving it to go somewhere safer, which I find interesting because it's almost like he's talking about a sanctuary, somewhere safer, when if you take a more modern talking about leaving society, you think about going back to the jungle, but he sees this as the jungle. He sees this as people at their worst. If anything, this is where we are, most barbaric, but hidden behind flattery
and niceties. Which ties into some of the imagery from last week's play, Death of a Salesman, where we have the description of the trees are on fire and the city is a jungle and hunting in the city and this like... but in that play, it's all about the desire to be a real man in the demasculating context of the urban environment. Whereas here, we have someone talking about the jungle of bitchy cruelty in Paris. Which
it's a jungle of gossip. It's a jungle of talk.
I would imagine that something like Liaison Dangereux is a far more accurate Dangerous Liaisons, as it was remade with who's in that movie? Malkovich.
Malkovich, John Malkovich, yeah. And the one from Glenn Close.
Glenn Close.
Yeah,
Roald Dahl's Witches.
No, that's what I was thinking of. I was thinking of the one, Bunny Boiler. I'm too tired.
Right. This we do make this show. We record at 4 a.m.
Yeah, absolutely.
Because it's the only time that we can get together.
It's actually the only time both of us can sustain awakeness.
Our other friends are so jealous of our friendship that we have to.
Yeah, we have to keep it secretly. Me secretly. In the back of your recording studio.
So where are we? The court case. He said, I want this to go down to posterity as a proof, that notorious testimony of the wickedness of the men of our age. Mm-hmm. This guy is such a whiner.
He is, yeah.
This is some first world problems right here. He's lost this case about his poetry criticism, and he's so rich that he doesn't even have to worry about the money.
Somehow I think 1666 lacks that sociological perspective we tend to have today in writing, though. Yeah. I'm not really thinking about the class system is yet to have that Marxist twist to it. Do you know what I mean? Like, we're not there yet.
I think you could be a little bit more aware, though. I mean, you've got Roman writers talking about the Colosseum and the horror of the dehumanizing force of mass entertainment.
Yeah, a post-Homerian person talking about 3rd century Greece as well, talking about it and its iniquity and losing its virtuosity.
But whereas to him, iniquity is just the fact that, you know, some dude's more friends with the king than him.
Yeah, and I have to, like, and he has to do it by flattery, and I'm sick of doing that because I can't do it because there's something maybe missing in me to be able to make such a conversion of truth. So yes, he's saying that he's going to make the trial his trial again. The idea of taking another institution of power, which he pretends doesn't have a hold over him, and he's going to flip it on its head and make it his own, which is something he's done twice now, which is a funny, funny part of the play.
Ferlent has a great line, Ferlent and Elantine, again, the two kind of moral centres of the play, mm-hmm. where he says, you know, I do agree with you, the world is run by intrigue, but all human failings give us in life the means of exercising our philosophy, which is a wonderfully existential way of looking at defeat and pain and every trial. It's very like Alan Watts's take on suffering, Durkha in the Buddhist tradition, the idea that it's not that it's given to us by God as a test, it's that it serves as an opportunity to define ourselves by contrast to how we would naturally respond to it.
It's also recognition of change, which again, another Buddhist concept of being part of the greater boat, the Yana boat as well, which is finally accepting that many of life's terms only exist in their opposite anyway. In other words, the point that's being made here by Flint or Flintine, or however you want to pronounce it, he's saying, yes, what you're saying is to some account true. These people are a little bit corruptive, but what does virtue mean without someone being not virtuous? What do these words mean without its counter opposite? In fact, doesn't he actually say that? Like, what does virtue mean if someone is not being virtuous, or if someone is not callow? What do these words actually have for you, unless you have their opposite? So he's trying to suggest that this is the plentitude of contradiction that is mankind. This is how we exist. In these contradictions, people make themselves. This is how they're born into a better identity, which is really, as you said, philosophical and quite profound for him to make that point. And probably the moment where he's now burgeoning up to be the real, not the main character, but certainly the person who's going to be coming away with something here.
Yeah, the hidden hero emerging from the shadow of the protagonist.
As compared to the trick that Shakespeare pulls where he just kills them off, only to have the tragic hero become the villain. But anyway, this is a side point. So yeah, he makes that point, which is quite beautiful. And then we then get Alceste kind of moving off, saying, no, I'm committed to this. And the last thing I'll do before running away is I'm going to go meet up with Célimène, and we're going to hash it out.
And so then we get this next batch of scenes 2 to 8, where we get all of these suitors asking for a decision. So Arant asks Célimène to give up Alcestra. Alcestra says, oh yes, give me up if you wish, pick one of us either way, and if you speak you've decided one, if you remain silent it's the other. So there's nothing she can do. And Also, Clitandre and Acaste arrive.
They, brought by Alceste, actually. He says that he met them before. Yeah, sorry.
He had arranged everything. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. He showed them the letter. And we get to hear this terrible letter, which is obviously ludicrously mild by modern standards. And what the letter is, it's not actually a declaration of love for anyone. There is a man addressed, but it's not clear who the man is. Actually, I don't think it's ever made clear who the letter is to.
I got the sense that they're both reading different variations of different letters, especially since they keep swapping it. In fact, when Clitandre picks it up, he picks up from where Acaste leaves off, but this time spelling Acaste as the person she's criticizing, because the letter couldn't possibly be criticizing all of them and yet addressed to one of them.
There has to be, and we didn't sit down and work it out, but it's probably whoever is left out. I suppose Valentine is the only one not directly insulted in the letter, so perhaps it was to him. I don't know. Although, he's the only one in love with someone else, isn't he, anyway? So,
yeah.
But so presumably it's to him. But whoever it's to, it's never made clear. But she has insults them each in turn. All the characters we've met, you know, she refers to a cast as, you know, the little Marquis. There's nothing so diminutive as his whole person, which is so good. There's nothing as small as all of you. You know, that's really cutting. And Alceste is the greatest bore in the world, which he kind of is.
But she's the only person he gives. She describes him with some credit.
Says
he can be entertaining sometimes.
Yeah, for occasionally I find him entertaining, but for the vast majority of the time he's the greatest bore in the world.
That coat he wears.
So this is a great kind of litany of this is the wit that has entertained them earlier is now where they're seeing the dark side of it. They're seeing the fact that she will wittily excoriate everyone and anyone. And Arant and Akast storm off, so annoyed that she says about Arant, his prose bores me as much as his poetry. In other words, when he talks, he's as bad as when he's writing. And Arsinoe leaves after having been given out to by Alceste for defending him.
Mm-hmm.
So that this we're left with Selamine and Alceste.
Yeah. So Alceste actually, after all of them saying I no longer care, or I think even Akast at one point says, you know what, I could act insulted, I could be driven by anger, but I'm not. I'm just going to take this and myself and Cassandra. We're going to hand this
again,
to everyone.
Again,
yeah.
The town, too big. The town would be hurt.
But it's just all these fantastic defenses hiding behind ideologies to try and protect the core, or to protect an emotion, or to protect the truth of it anyway. Which he puts down as, we're going to tell everybody, me and Clotandra, but we won't do it with malice. Like, this is not anger. This is just something we have to do. As you put it, Gareth, you know, doing it for the town. That kind of
attitude. Yeah, they're going to go around with this letter and show it to everyone, ruining her reputation, which is kind of a shocking thing. You know, if we imagine this time when the reputation was everything, and especially a woman's reputation.
Yes, of course.
She will be ruined in society. And they're kind of leaving her with no alternative. What a cleverer suitor. I mean, these are all 10 years old emotionally. The cleverer suitor would have been, you know, would have laughed with her. Oh, yeah. You called me a midget. That's ridiculous. I am a midget. It's hilarious, isn't it? Yeah. These are all idiots that are taking it seriously.
They would push it back.
Let's hook up.
There's no suppression here. They're straight with the anger that they're pretending isn't anger.
Huge egos.
They leave to go and defend them and deflate this woman. But Alceste sees an opportunity and says, okay, we know you're going to get ruined, but I forgive you.
Oh, he doesn't say he forgives her. Well, I can never forgive you, but yeah, I'll tolerate it.
I'll tolerate it. That's it. Sorry, I'm completely wrong. It's like, I'm willing to...
Perfidious creature, I'm willing to forget your crimes.
He describes her as perfidious 50 times. Yeah.
He's really horrible.
Yeah.
And he will forgive her so long as she agrees to join him in, quote, avoiding all human creatures. So, don't worry. I love you, but you do need to live in my basement.
Essentially, like, it is a Merkel thing. No, it's not Merkel. Sorry, it is a slightly Fritz thing. Completely different people, but there is a Fritz element of look.
Joseph Fritzl.
Yes,
not Fritz Lang. Fritz,
not Fritz Lang. No, it's a Fritzl thing, which is like, get in the basement. Like, I will put a I'm a great dungeon builder.
I'll wall us both in. Don't worry.
Yeah, exactly. We'll both be in there. But you got to commit to never talking to anyone else again.
I think even in the world of the play, at this point where he's decided he's gonna wander off into that he is nuts. I think we're supposed to think that
he's
a bit bonkers.
But I think that's the content there is that's what it is to be, at least attempting to be almost totally honest.
Yeah, some truth.
Yeah, is to be insane because it falls against the many illusory elements of society that you have to in some way compromise, which he refuses to do. And that's, you know, sure, that's at the crux of this. But also maybe he's a bit mad. There is another line in this I quite liked, which it comes up earlier, where you have to admit, Gareth, you can sometimes understand where Alceste is coming from.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah. I think we've all had this man inside of us
I don't think he's always crazy because it's not exclamated or particularly loud. Sometimes he's just making a loud point and some people will let it go when it's funny. But there's a line here which is, moderate your passions.
Mm-hmm.
Right, and it's said at one point, it's moderate your passions or hold yourself back. Those are the actual terms. And what I'm picking on that is interesting is that this is a person who's not even that angry sometimes, but he's just making a real honest claim, particularly to Selamine. But you're in a society where when you finally reveal something like that, if you were to actually reveal that you're angry, if you're actually to reveal a sense of possessiveness, it's rapidly put down. And in fact, they say, and that's why I think that moderate your passions is the first time she's honest about it. But most of the time they just say, stop jibing. In fact, she says a number of times, you're insulting me, I assume, or you are joking, because they can't let it be an uncategorized chaotic perturbance. It has to be, oh no, that's a joke.
Again, this is why people find him funny, and he doesn't mm-hmm. realize he's joking. Everyone yes, exactly. thinks he's being tremendously ironic and satirical, but actually he's just really annoyed.
Exactly. And that's why the idea of censuring comes up. But in this case, they're censoring his censure. So he's trying to be formal, but he's saying something that is crazy and outside of their understood formality. So his censures get censored by their social capital. In this case, their social joke. They put it down into a language of, that's a joke, or moderate your feelings, you're being a bit mad. When actually all he's saying is, no, I have feelings. This is what I feel.
True, but it's also true that his feelings are very self-centered.
Yes.
Entirely egocentric.
Which is for all of them, though, except for Eliant.
But he has no, you know, he talks about the nobility of virtue, but the virtues only apply to him mm-hmm. and to other people's treatment of him.
Mm-hmm.
He's a very, a dethronement would be the term. Again, I think it's a Kleinian term. He has not moved beyond his own personal victory being the test of the moral test of the world. In fact, he says, you know, this court's judgment against me will stand for all time as a sign of how unfair the world is. I mean, no one gives a shit about the poetry court. Sorry, even then.
You know? Yeah, exactly. No one did.
But he's so egocentric that he can't look beyond his own personal umbrage and his own personal feelings of inadequacy, this huge defensive frame that he's built of he is the only moral person and actually do some good for someone.
The only sane man delusion that comes about a lot, which is not so much the client, but that's like, I remember reading about that not just to make a comparison or shit. I also know female psychoanalytic people, but Moroda also talked about that. But
Karen.
I quite liked her because didn't I show you, just as an off topic, but didn't I show you a while ago with Rina Lacan, him ripping through some of Moroda's material? In fact, he outright says, like, because she made a silly claim, as she often does, he's pretty cruel. He's a cruel man. But going back to our cruel characters in this play, see, I could tie it back in. It's a seg. If you go back to Alceste, His madness is coming to the fore at the end, and I will admit that. And you're talking about this idea of he's aware of virtue, and he's also aware of sentiment. There should be sentiment to things. But it goes back to, I don't know if you've read much Tolstoy, but there's this great paraphrase story that Tolstoy has given.
You should open up a parties with that line.
I've never done that.
Don't know if you know.
It's for you, Gareth. It's for no one else.
I don't know if you've read much Tolstoy, but...
I don't know, though. Maybe you have.
No, I haven't read any Tolstoy.
But you're right. It is a delivery line for me to get this fucking package across,
it's pretty good, though.
Which is now being set on fire.
All right, love.
So,
don't know if you've read much Tolstoy.
Yeah, exactly. But please...
Do you look like Anna Karenina?
But like... No, I'd never go, because I actually have read Tolstoy is the problem. Like, it can't just be a line.
Yeah.
But he talks about this case of the women who only experience sentiment subjectively. You know, he doesn't say that word. It's not really a word around them. But the story goes like this. It's the women who go into the plays and experience sentiment and cry as their coach drivers are freezing to death outside.
Yeah.
Do you see what I'm saying? It's this idea of sentiment is only being experienced subjectively and it's never being driven outwards. The two people in this play, including Eliant and Philantine, are actually able to act out sentiment. He is a person who, while is amazing at subjectively perceiving it, is never allowing it to go past the subjective. It is only in himself, which is the point that Tolstoy was making with those women. They will experience and cry and they'll weep to these great plays, but they won't give a shit about the factors of society around them. It is only a selective moment of insight.
But I think that's also the great gulf between we can read Dickens or Tolstoy or something of the 19th century, and the 19th century is the modern world. You know, the clothes are different, but the idea that...
Modernism, yeah.
Yeah, but more than just that, the idea that all humans are human.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, even a century after this, even, you know, 18th century stuff like the battle against slavery in the United States and in England, won in England in the 18th century, we have this idea of universal humanity, maybe not suffrage, but universal humanity. In they're not quite there yet in 1666 in France.
I wasn't going to say Durero Natura, but they're not quite at the lock-in, more naturist, like acceptance of a higher deity, but an awareness that here is what counts. And that's inherent in the king. And it's funny you describe them as children, because Lynne Higgins, as well as, if you ever read Pete Brooks, he does a lot of narratology. And he walks through what's different between 19th century fiction compared to the fiction that came before it when they import the same manner rules. And the big difference is that they've had two revolutions in France. And that's a literary centre of the world. It's one of the big places where literature comes from.
And
the
and same one in England.
Yes.
Shortly after this.
Exactly. And this dethroning, this beheading of the king, revealed that he wasn't a divine anointed presence that somehow sits above us, a great superego or other. He wasn't that at all. That he was just a man. And there was some discovery in that killed a paternal aspect of the psyche of society, the idea of a father, a greater father watching over you, which left people with this kind of sense of abyss, this left behind non-authority where rules have to stand by something different now than the king. And in that fear, as well as the growing ability to read because of the Stanhope presses, which, well, Stanhope came later, but the printing presses, the I was going to say Garou, but the many inventions of those people that would now spread to the wilds.
And of course, the rediscovery of classical literature, because the Arabic world kept alive so much of the literature of Athens, particularly, which represented a state that did not have a king.
Mm-hmm.
And there have been many societies that were in some form democratic. But that was a thing that was almost willfully forgotten or imagined as pagan and primitive in some way.
Mm.
And it's only at this period and shortly after that people start to look into the past for ways of analysing the present, and the revolutionary zeal and the quest for liberty, equality and joining a secret society. And they discover, oh, look, you know, actually you can have a, maybe they only did it with 200, you know, white guys in, I guess they were sallow in Greece or in Athens. But, you know, maybe we can extend the franchise and all comes a little bit after. So this is kind of the last gasp of a certain kind of utterly alienated from the common man.
Yeah. With a foundational delusion of a greater deity to hand off difficult moral questions to. Something, a sense of not being responsible for a lot, where now man, if he was truly, you know, the more intellectual man is truly responsible for so much that it's almost paralyzing.
But
so
even Shakespeare writing, I think I'm going to, Shakespeare, like the 1640s or is it earlier? 1580s?
Yeah.
So Shakespeare is writing in a world that isn't like this. There's no delineation between the common man and the aristocrat in terms of humanity.
Mm-hmm.
All of the characters are human, but here the servants are, you slap them on the head, they're it's like Fawlty Towers. It's, you know, the Spanish
Manuel
character, like that's the level of humanity they have. Maybe it's just Moliere, I don't know. I don't know a lot of French literature from this time, but it's very pointed to me.
Yeah,
the absence of any characters that aren't friends with the king.
Yeah,
I just can't get over that. So anyway, we're almost at the end of the play, and this demand that she come with him, and she says, Selamine says, you know, solitude is frightful to a widow of 20, which is beautiful, beautiful. Because I don't know, I assume that what she means by that is that, you know, well, she's widowed from society. This letter is going to ruin her. So she realizes, and she will accept him. She offers to accept him.
She'll take a marriage. In fact, she says, there's a wedding band. I'll take a ring, like marry me. But that's not on his terms, because he'd know that he would still in some way either have to compete or remain in the world in which he wants to run from.
And then he says, he turns to Aliant, who previously declared that she was very attracted to him.
I'll take you now.
He says, yes, I have a heart unworthy of you. And she says, yeah, keep going with that. I'm going to go off with Valentine because your heart really is unworthy of me, you shallow fucker.
Yeah. And in Valentine's holding up of you and being a good guy, I'm going to go with him. Like, and 300 or so years from now, a lot of rom-coms will depict this where the nice guy wins.
Yeah, Mr. Nobly.
Yeah.
So Alcest melodramatically exits with the following speech. Deceived on all sides, overwhelmed with injustice, I will fly from an abyss where vice is triumphant and seek out some small secluded nook on earth where one may enjoy the freedom of being an honest man. My name is John Galt.
Whoa. Yes, so he goes off to find his nook.
Yes, his gulch.
His little nook to cranny. He'll go and dig his way into a hole and be away from the forest.
All right, okay. Enough with the...
Okay, I'm just saying. I'm just saying the man has interestingly placed himself...
Enough with the womb imagery.
Yeah. Anyway, he runs home to his pre-beautiful land.
to the Oceanic State, and Valentine and Alant, magnanimous as always, resolved to marry and to go off and get him back. So, that is the story of the play.
Mm-hmm.
All that remains is to discuss the meat.
Yeah.
Which we're now almost 2 hours in, so probably quite quickly.
Yeah. Okay, so you go.
So we got some themes, we got some world of the play.
I thought we got all that done in the reading of it.
No, not at all, not at all. So we've already talked about the romance of male friendship, but I, you know, was reading about this, and there's some research done by a sociologist called Niobe Way, and she looked at male friendships in children. And how the intimacy of male friendships diminishes entering an adulthood, and how that parallels exactly suicidality. So, as you may or may not know, men, especially young men, commit suicide
more,
at a greater rate, a hugely greater rate than women. Women attempt suicide, men tend to commit it. Mm-hmm. And one reason is that women are able to maintain intimacy in their friendships.
Mm-hmm.
And this is something that at this point in history, we're seeing this kind of, there's a lot of breakups and whining between the guys, but their embraces are, you know, very close. And, you know, my this is a path theory, but my feeling about it is that Because you read stuff from the 40s, which is very similar to this in America, the United Kingdom, is that the emergence of the shadow, the bad side of the emergence of homosexuality as an identity, mm-hmm. rather than just an inclination, is that people have, men have become, to safeguard their machismo, have become more inhibited in their friendships.
Mm.
I don't know. That's a theory, but
no, I'm not. It's not that I doubt the theory that we, you know, how the hell would you test that, and where's the report going to come from? I don't know. Maybe there's some way to survey. We'll get the statistics, people of Ireland. We'll get to whoever does that here. In our
CSO, support.
Yeah, CSO here. But like, I my experience is just completely. It's true and it's untrue. It's true in spots, but usually at a very young age, so secondary school level, teenage life with some angst, and then going into maybe some young adulthood. But ultimately, I've not really experienced that at all. I think that men tend to be very, very close, the ones I've perceived. And I'm saying this as someone who has a lot of hang-ups with, you know, physical intimacy and a lot of issues being neurotic, but this is, I tend to see that men are a lot closer.
They did some research this year, mm-hmm. and they found that the average American man had no friends.
Oh, really?
Like, how many close friends do you have that you would talk about X, Y, and Z?
Yeah, yeah.
The median was zero. Obviously not the average. That would be impossible.
And that was in America, though. I think there is obviously a geographical thing to take place.
No, I think in modern Western society, people are hugely alienated. Primarily men.
Okay, I'm not saying
alienated.
That's not true. That's a different claim, though.
But I don't mean alienated from a grand sociological sense. I mean alienated from their ability to connect emotionally with one
another. But I would make the same argument because I brought up the Rollo May discussion that particularly came out of Love and Will, which is there is a schizoid dilemma appearing in human beings. But I'm saying to the point of men being more restricted through machismo attitude, which is this, whether going the Latin American route or not, mm-hmm. the idea of being tough and I'm just not seeing that as much.
Well, there's different kinds of toughness, you know, and yeah. I agree. It doesn't necessarily manifest as, in fact, the guys who are, you know, ripped, as we both are, of course.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
If you can picture us, let's say we're both 8 feet tall and
topless. We push weights while we're reading this as well.
We do.
Yeah.
I've got one in my bum right now. but those guys actually tend to be more comfortable with intimate friendships.
Way dirtier with that. Yeah, go on.
Because I don't know, there's an element to which their hypermasculinity provides a defense. Of course I'm not gay because I'm so macho, and even if I was, I'd still be straight. Mm-hmm. And
yeah, or the girl on the phone thing, which is all the home screens and phones, phone pictures are always really attractive hot women from Suede or another odd, yeah. An odd Swedish like calendar company.
You know, I had a weird experience. I was on a bus a couple of days ago, and there were some very kind of muscular, shaved-headed Eastern European men, mm-hmm. like 18, 20, very energetic. They're probably tripping balls, I'm not sure. Mm-hmm. And one of them got a text message from a guy who had made friends with, and he was like, he read it to his friends, and it said something like, I realized, I didn't get the whole thing, but that there are other people who are different, and you're one of them, and I realized, you know, we should be friends. And they were like, gay! And
Jesus.
That, you know, that's an extreme example, but there's an element of that, and there certainly has been. Maybe it's going to change or is changing. Maybe people 10 years younger than I am, it's different. I don't know, but I can definitely say that in my cohort of men, there's an enormous alienation from deep friendship.
There was a moratorium on it in secondary school. There was a don't touch. Everybody's don't homosexual. Touch. If you and then at the same time, do touch, but in a frivolous mocking of homosexuality right. / I want to get closer to you. Maybe there's something here, which I perceived a lot in my class, which was the whole sitting on laps, which is like, oh, you let me sit in your lap. You must be gay. And you're thinking, but you're sitting on my lap and no one asked you to. So what are you doing? There was so much weird tilting wow. right on exactly tilting right on the edge of it to the point where like many of those guys I'm sure went on to be you know the kind of guys who'd have to go into a hotel room, tie themselves up and put a fucking snooker cue up their ass. But look, it's these people were dark, right? The way they did it was odd, as dark as that poorly delivered statement I just gave a second ago. And there was a moratorium on it. You just couldn't talk about it, and homosexuality was just something that was used to insult people. Now that was my secondary school, and that was Benilda's, and I'm happy to insult her for being that because that's what it was, and that was my experience of
it. Your school was called Brunhilde's.
Benilda's. Oh, not Brunhilde's. It wasn't a German school. No,
it was a Valkyrie school.
No, that's a different thing. That's
okay, I picture you doing...
That's ethnographic and stuff studies, yeah.
I picture you doing Mensur fencing, you know, with one cut across the cheek to show nobility, you know.
Yeah, absolutely.
The nose guards and all the rest of it.
Well, playing many of the Valkyrie stuff. So that's that. But there was a shift. There was a kind of a...
It was me and Barry began.
No, not for me. I mean, what I perceived. So when I went into college, it was completely different. It had shifted completely. There were still those men who couldn't get over those hang-ups
in secondary
school.
That was a little Irish joke. Shift means kiss in Irish rural.
No, I don't. You know, very funny, but I know I don't mean that. Yes. But the transition was that there was apparently a moral event horizon that I missed, which I'm glad was happening. We went to college and a lot of people were now a lot more intimate and it was understood and men could actually joke about being gay in a way that was almost telling of it and it was less triangulated. isolated and distanced, if you see what I'm saying, in the subversion of language. That's just what I saw, and it was completely different. Now, there were still those men who were from my secondary school that looked exactly the same and performed the same antics and had the same hang-ups, and they tended to join the same student union. There's a lot to be said for that aggregating based on, ideologies, but that's just the way it went for me. That's how I perceived it. So please tell me your experience of the shift.
Well, it's just not, it's been the opposite. It's been, in childhood, lots of intimate friendships, and then as you get older, that becoming almost like assessed here, this, you know, separating from people in ways that were unnecessary because there was a fear of intimacy. Not my part. Mm-hmm. I've always been desperate for human intimacy, like a strange crab creature.
Oh yeah, you hug like crazy.
but I don't know. I had a, as you know, tragedy. A friend of mine died this week, and we all went to the funeral, and it makes you think about closeness to people, and we were all trying to be very caring to one another. Our mutual friends of his, you know, and it made me realize how much we're not in general, you know, how much we retreat into other ways of showing affection that are based around humor and cruelty and whatever. And maybe that's just the schizoid kids I know, but it certainly ties into Ireland, particularly has a huge rate of male suicide. It's one of the highest in the world. And I've done a bit of, it's probably obvious to everyone listening that we both have this unhealthy interest in psychoanalysis and psychology, but I've done a bit of therapeutic work, and I certainly came across that kind of feeling in client work, that just this complete inability to forge real connections with people.
Yes.
Amongst male clients. Okay. Not everybody, but you know, it's a thing that you come across. And I see it. I don't know.
I do see what you just said. I just don't necessarily, it's the way in which you delivered this idea that there's a continuation of that Dago macho, strong man, alpha male stuff.
Well, that was probably a miss. In this culture, that wasn't the case. And certainly in our culture, it's not. But
I think intimacy is taken just a different, it's just taken a different step. I don't mean to discredit what you just said, because I'm with that. I completely believe that there's a real schizoid dilemma in the world, that we're all universally suffering different variations of that, what we call the schizoid dilemma. I mean, there's a whole spectrum for it. And I think that definitely men are feeling more alienated. And I know I'm one of them, and as many as, not a claim of victimhood, but I think I know it from being it, and many others.
Yeah, it's not about victimhood. Yeah. It's not about some sort of identity politics.
No, it's not about that at all.
It's about connecting with people. And if anything, all of that victimhood culture and oppression Olympics stuff is a way of pushing people away and creating out groups to selectively dehumanize other people because of their beliefs or their
more demarcations, more useless demarcations, which aren't going to help. If anything, it's unification at the cost of being uncomfortable, at the cost of people not liking what other people say and having different ideologies.
And that's a hard thing. And that's what this play, you know, for all that has grand philosophical questions and so on, it's really about that. It's about how hard it is to accept people's imperfections and to still accept them. And I know I find that hard. And there are people that we both know who I've decided I do not no longer want to deal with. And
it's a tactic I've pulled as well. And I want to make it clear to people, may think, what does that even mean? Sure, you don't like someone. No, I mean, I know for you, Gareth, and definitely for me, and as I explained to you before, and it's part of, they call it part of the schizoid dilemma as well as other things, but I've outright broken contact with someone, just said, nope.
End of the romance.
And it's not something we talk about. I see people use that again as a kind of currency to suggest that they have the power to emotionally cut ties. They talk about it as if it's a control. I don't see it as good or healthy. I just saw it as something that happened.
It's kind of an urgent protective need for a weak ego. And I feel it's all too common in male society. And maybe there, I don't know. But you can think too much about stuff. Maybe there's a famous set of studies called the Whitehall studies, where they looked at...
I think I know the Whitehall studies,
So they looked at... Whitehall is where all the civil servants work in the United Kingdom. And they had all this information from 30 years of Whitehall, who died at what ages and so on. So they looked at social stratification and discovered that the people at the bottom of the Whitehall hierarchy and the people at the top were a lot better off than the people in the middle. And I feel that there is a kind of a, if you are an aristocrat, there is all sorts of deviances and weirdnesses accepted, and all sorts of broken intimacies and public school weirdness and everything. And if you were, this is going to sound condescending, but I don't mean it in that way, but if you are working class, then there is a more kind of camaraderie, and maybe there's a bit of homophobia to it too, but there's a lot of, you know, drunken, we'll fight it out and then we're just as good friends again. But if you're middle class,
there is a kind of, in both of those things are, you know, one is too you know, strange and perverse, and the other is too animal. And
one's too theatrical, one's too base.
Yeah, and there's some sort of middle ground of reasonableness that is deadening and alienating.
Mm-hmm.
But that's just my
experience. I mean, I've always thought it was a middle class problem as well. And there's a burgeoning, growing middle class, as there always has been. It's the biggest of any population, and that's where.
Although we would certainly aspire to climb to the king's favor.
Oh yeah, of course.
I will curry anything. I'll praise any
narcissism
poem.
All the way.
I will tell you your verses are the greatest gilded lily in the history.
Exactly, but just put us on TV. Give us a show. Give us all the fame. Give us some creativity that we can hide behind. Just give it to us, and then we will do whatever. I mean,
NPR all the way.
You want to go national public radio? You want to go that? Want to go that route?
Listen, I'm already besties with Roman Mars here.
Oh yeah, of course, yes.
Okay, I met him once.
Yeah.
He was very nice. Okay, so what else? Okay, so more themes. So we've talked about the philosophy of life embracing versus rejecting people. Mm-hmm. There's also this idea of the loss of virtue from the world. And this is something you see in lots of literature. But it's increasingly hilarious the further back in time it is when mm-hmm. they're saying people nowadays. And they literally say it in the play.
Yeah.
Yeah, no, people, that may be, we all know what you need to do to please a boy nowadays.
Yeah.
Before this amazing pre-Socratic moment where all you needed to do was of sound virtue and they would float towards you and
have massive oiled muscles and also at times be Prometheus and bind yourself for others. That's it. That's apparently what you had to be. It's nonsense. Again,
open a fetish club
again, study of 3rd century Greece had people making similar claims, you know, post Socrates, Aristotle commentary, and you find that people were still just saying we've lost something.
Yeah. Every civilization does this. Mm-hmm. In Irish Celtic mythology situates the golden time in Chir na n-Og, and we have all of these marvelous figures from pre-written Ireland, from pre-Christian Ireland,
mm-hmm.
who were able to gut a salmon and gain the wisdom of the ages, or
because salmon would tell them,
yeah.
as they were gutting it,
or live thousands of years and all this kind of nonsense. And it's this putting in the past. This, what it really is, I think, is it's a psychological way of projecting outwards the fact that as you grow older, you become more constrained in your behaviors, less layable, and so you convince yourself you're more mature and wise. And rather, you say, oh, young people today, but you also say, back in my day, and my day becomes this sort of universal way of thinking about it.
Yeah. Maybe not a pre-edible dream, but something on that level of the before was the greatest civilization, the Ancien Regime, you know, when Charles was around. It was great king.
Catalonia during the war.
I just say Kathmandu, just because I like the name.
But you know, it's this idea of in anarchist discourse of Catalonia as being this utopia that lasted for 3 years while they fought Franco off and everybody had their own collective. And wouldn't it have been great to last? And it would. It sounds pretty good, actually.
Yeah, it did sound great.
Yeah.
Different times. Well, once could have been.
It's all gone.
It is.
There's also work in the play Projective Identification. Mm-hmm. We've got this character who goes around being a dick to everyone. And guess what? It nips him in the ass.
Yeah.
And just like Selimi as well. She is the classic person who derides everyone. And then in a kind of mean girls fashion, they all hear about it because there was a group call. They didn't know someone else was on the line.
Exactly. Yeah. And they caught the call in the chain letter or in one letter. And they were able to catch
Shibber at her finest.
Yep. Or Amy Adams or whoever it was that was doing
Amy
that
Adams.
No, it wasn't Amy Adams. Who was in that film again?
No, it was.
She was in.
You went from.
She was in the Tinker Tailor Soldier Spy new movie thing.
Oh, was she?
Joseph Carr book.
Oh, that's a great movie.
Did you do the new one?
If you haven't seen the movie, I recommend it. I know you're
Most Wanted Man, right?
Tinker Tailor Soldier Spy.
That's an amazing movie.
It's so good.
I love Tinker Tailor. Have you seen The Most Wanted Man, the new film?
No, is that a follow-up?
It's John Le Carré story turned to, but based loosely on a real case.
Is it good?
Watch it, man. I don't know. I actually don't know. And people are crediting it very highly. And I don't know. It's missing something. There's things there that aren't quite right. And there's a central character. I mean, it's Philip Seymour Hoffman's last great film. And Philip Seymour Hoffman is incredible in it.
Yeah.
But there's something missing. So... I won't get into the pieces yet. But
it's weird watching a movie starring a ghost.
Yeah. That's I'm just saying. Yeah, I don't know what to do.
The nature of love, controlling love versus controlling jealousy versus philandering manipulation. We have these two figures who are both loved, Selamine and Alceste, whose
unfairly names
loved. Butchering. Both are loved by people they don't love, and both loving one another, and only really loving one another because they're such obstreperous individuals, and both bound in this
world where it's not even a virginity taboo, it's a peck on the cheek taboo. Mm-hmm. The letter of interest is enough to ruin you in society.
Yeah.
Although I'm sure that's exaggerated for comedic effect. I think Molière is writing quite a gentle piece on the face of it.
Yeah.
So, you know, we do have things like...
But it's about the exposure of interest of one over another, which is singling out, which is acting out, which causes the contrary and other possible realities to break and fold and melt, which is what her biggest problem is anyway. Célimène is this person who doesn't want to ruin her potentiality. She wants to maintain it in constant power. And I feel that Alceste doesn't want to ruin his potentiality and in the wish that they've credited him with by continually being a contrarian ass to a pointless degree, because maybe if he was to give that up, something would be amiss there. Maybe he'd lose the power he holds over people, because his critical faculties are the thing that they keep crediting him for, and yet it's also what makes him an asshole. And I wonder, is it just like Célimène, is that something he can't quite forfeit, even though people have asked him to, much like he asks her to forfeit her potential of men? They both won't let it go.
This is another great theme of the play. Is character something that you can work on? You know, are the more magnanimous characters, are they better people, or is that just how they are?
Mm-hmm.
And we have someone who can't, they've got this, Selma has this amazing wit and she can't help use it. She can't help cutting everyone down for the entertainment of it and the erogenous thrill of it. And Alceste can't help trying to be noble and good in a way that is brutish and rude.
Yeah. I mean, it's said by Célimène at one point where he's complaining to her the first time they meet, and he's saying, you have too many suitors and you're too nice to them and their flattery is so meaningless. Why would you give them this nonsense reply? Like, why do you feed into it? She does say, I feel that you can only like people by I feel that you can only show your like for people by being insulting, by being basically boorish, by being horrible. That's the only way you can show your like. And how I show mine is by being liking, which is, again, that's her lying completely. Mm-hmm. But it's also recognizing his nature, which is that this is the way in which he shows emotion, which is through constant, pernicious, but at the same time, highly pro-erit articulations of people's problems. It's unwinding of this large insultation to a witty degree. And I wonder, is that scene showing a connection between the two of them? I don't know. But anyway, by the ending, the two of them are connected, but at the same time, they can't be together.
Yeah, so, I like to think that he's going to come back and they're going to have to be together.
If he breaks that, he'll be even less attractive to her.
Well, that's the fate of us all, to be less attracted to the one that we're forced to be with.
Oh, shit. Can't do that. Gotta keep them attracted. Don't give them the reality.
We've cracked our limit.
Yeah.
Over 2 hours again.
Excellent.
Thank you so much to everyone again on Reddit who listened and commented. If you want to email any play texts violating copyright in the process, that would greatly facilitate your play getting to the top of the list, because the tragedy is we are bound, unlike the wealthy denizens of 17th century France, we are bound by the constraints of economic climes. And if you can send us a play that is in software form that we can both read without having to buy it, we would much more likely to discuss it. So please do send it on to me at garethstack.com.
Mm-hmm.
And we will decide now what our next play will be. And then we will append on this the name of the play at the very end.
Hello, it's me, Gareth. The next day. So our play for next week is Arcadia by Tom Stoppard, chosen by Jazzy Clan. Thank you.